morning, and welcome to Wanda's Picks at a New Time. A program of the African Sisters Media Network, and we are so excited today. We're going to be talking to William Rhodes about an art exhibit that he has currently at the San Francisco Main Library in the African American Center, and that's on the third level, I believe. And it's a really wonderful exhibition, as all of his exhibitions are, and here he is in the studio. Good morning, William. How are you?
Good morning. How are you?
Oh, I'm excellent, excellent. I'm just so sad that your exhibit is coming down tomorrow. Like, is there any possibility that they're going to extend it? Goodness gracious, we have to all rush over there today and tomorrow.
Thank you.
Wow.
Well, to answer your question, I haven't received any notification of an extension, but it has been well received. The reason why, there's going to be an amazing show coming up by an artist by the name of Karen Seneferu, and so she's coming up right after me. So I think they're excited about that as well.
Oh, we're gonna have to bring this back because I didn't know it was there. Like, how long has it been up? Like a month or something, and I'm just hearing about it or just remembering it or what?
Yeah, it's been up for quite a while. It actually went up it's been up for well over a month. I think it's been up close to 2 months.
Oh, my goodness. Really? How
yeah.
did I miss it? You mean it's been up since December?
Mm-hmm. It has.
Oh, my goodness. And all of January, which is a very long month.
Yeah, yeah. But I understand. I mean, it's a lot going on. But it has been. I've been very fortunate. It's been well received. I've gotten some really good press written. You know, I had a few stories written about the exhibition.
Nice.
And now I'm lucky enough to be on your show. So it's been really good.
Wow. Well, you know, we always love having you because I remember the email, you know, you're telling me that it was coming, going up. You know, this wonderful exploration of, you know, the Mamiwata and Yemenja, and only the way you can tell the story because, you know, you use, you know, you're a visual artist, but also, you know, you build things. And so your work has a real tangible element. It's not just flat.
Thank you.
So, yeah, it's just really beautiful, and I am so interested in the topic. I was like, oh no, it's closing. Oh shoot, Thursday.
Well,
oh my God.
The good news is there's a possibility. I have a person who has agreed or wanted to actually offered, I should say, to actually help me turn it into a catalog form. So many of the images, we're still working on getting, I'm working on producing some better images of the work, but it could actually be in solid form at some point and actually produced into like a book catalog form. So if you don't get to see it that way, I'd love to show it to you. And for any listeners, it's going to be offered online, so you know, you'll be able to buy the catalog if in the future.
Nice. That's awesome. That's really awesome. We're just talking and talking and haven't even introduced you and haven't let the people know what they're missing, particularly those who are in the San Francisco Bay Area, like, oh, no, I don't have time to get a flight.
They may want to take a flight compared to the weather on the East Coast, I have to say.
Yeah, so, you know, we've had you on before, you know, talking about blacks in the future and mm-hmm. your Dia de los Muertos, you know, you work with the young people in Bayview, the spirit houses. I mean, you know, you work with them every year to put together, you know, an exhibition for SOMARTS. But I think it was last year, spirit houses, where you had them doing these wonderful three-dimensional works or four-dimensional
mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was really, really, really beautiful.
Thank
so
you.
Tell us about this exhibit. You've traveled quite a bit. I didn't know you had been all the places you've been until I read your bio. I was like, wow, William gets around. Look at him. I mean, you've been really traveling throughout the African diaspora, which is so wonderful. Africa, Asia, Central and South America. And then you actually have pieces of these places in the work.
I do, yeah.
At, about the spirit, you know, of the water. Yeah, so tell us about the exhibition and sort of how many, you know, how long it took you to pull it all together.
It's taken years to really pull all of the pieces together. It really started, I guess I got my initial inspiration, the title is Souls of Water, memories of the pretty much people that are connected or the connection that we have with the African diaspora. But the title is Souls of Water, Memories of the African Diaspora. It came about with Hurricane Katrina. When that event happened, it was a nationwide impact, but it also had an impact on me personally because I have family members that are in New Orleans. And it started to make me really look at the whole concept of water and how does that affect people in a positive and also negative way. And so that's really when the artwork really started for this particular show. The show itself chronicles the relationships that people of the African diaspora have with water, in particularly focusing on, you know, I would say African Americans, but it goes beyond that. It starts with the worship of Mami Water or of the different water deities. And, you know, it's believed in ancient times in Africa that the goddesses of water are the creators of everything. Everything comes out of that. And we all know that, you know, all human life comes out of water. Scientifically, that's been proven. So it starts there, and then we work our way around with my show. I work my way around to the whole concept of parts of Africa, you know, fighting for survival, dealing with the issues of water, the importance and the scarcity of water in certain locations, and the abundance of water in other locations. And then we work our way around to I have a piece that I dedicated to my dad. If you get to see the catalog or get to see the show today, there is a box that I made that has buttons and different items sewn on top of it and a photograph of my dad. Inside of this box is a Bible, which looks really weathered and torn. And that Bible was actually used by my dad when he was marching in the Civil Rights Movement when he was attending University of Maryland Eastern Shore. He actually marched, carried that Bible, and when they turned the water hoses on him, he used that Bible as a shield for his face. So the Bible's really twisted and turned because of the water. So that's actually in the show. So we work our way around from ancient times into the more modern times to the civil rights movement, the impact of water, and then we come to the pieces that I did around Hurricane Katrina. So those are some of the areas that are being touched, or some of the themes, I should say, of the exhibition.
Oh, wow, interesting. Wow, what a great story about your father and the Bible and water as, you know, as a weapon, you know, being used against, you know, those that were, you know, protesting for their human rights.
Yeah.
And, it's interesting, you know, you see water as sort of this benign fluid that, you know, it takes the shape of its container. It's, you know, it's the thing that, you know, we don't necessarily pay too much attention to until we don't have any.
Exactly. That's a very good point.
And you're right. You know, the human body, what are we, 90% water or something like that?
Yeah, 80 or 90%.
We're mostly water. You wouldn't think it looking at us, would you?
No. And we forget that.
Yeah, and then we think about, you know, those huge bodies of water that connect the different landforms, you know, the continents to one another, and we think about the journeys that, as you mentioned earlier, you know, that connect us as a people in the African diaspora. Talk about your travels and your pieces that, you know, have pieces of, you know, these landforms. You mentioned that in one of your pieces you have a stone from Goree.
Yes, yes.
And, yeah.
And I should have mentioned this, too, because that falls into it as well, as far as the themes. So this piece is called The Middle Passage. It's a circular-shaped piece. It's carved wood, and it has a face, a pretty smooth face, carved wooden face on one side, and on the other side of the piece there is a skull. And there are mirrors all around it, and it has carvings of water, like waves that go around the entire piece. So the whole piece is surrounded by this water shape. On the back of the piece, when you flip it, I cut a little window inside of the piece, and in that window I put a stone. That stone is actually from the slave holding cells that was in Goree Island. And for anyone that doesn't know what Goree Island is, that was a place in Senegal, West Africa, where these slaves or people were actually taken, put into these holding cells, and there's a door upstairs on top of the holding cells. And ships would pull up, and then the slaves would be loaded onto the ship and then sent to the Americas. So to be in that holding cell, and I actually got to spend time. I spent an hour in that cell, and it was pitch black. There's still a smell. There's still a really strong energy in that space. I mean, it's really indescribable, and it's an emotional feeling just walking into that space. I was the only one in that space at one point, and I was able to experience that. And I got a piece of stone from that cell, and I was just, in my mind, just imagining what energy went into those walls, and if my ancestors, if their hands could have brushed against that stone or touched that stone, and what emotions they were feeling right before they got loaded on that ship and they would never see their home again, which is, you know, the continent of Africa. So that stone is in that piece. So it has that piece has some amazing energy in it just by, you know, capturing, having that stone in it.
Yeah, I'm looking at one of the images you sent me, and it's the metal is silver, and you've got waves on it, and then the water sort of goes around the face of a carving in wood, and it seems like in both of them you have like a third eye at the top,
yeah.
And then in this particular one you have a skull on the other side of the piece, and you have these big interesting shapes, you know, some we can recognize and some are more creative. I mean, the ones we can recognize, oh, this is a circle and this is a triangle, but then there's another shape that this one doesn't fit into that category because it's not a square. It's got little rounded edges. Yeah, I was wondering if you could talk about sort of, you know, being a, you know, craftsman and being a fine artist and sort of how all this comes together in these really beautiful pieces.
Thank you. Well, you know, I have a background. I was actually trained as a furniture maker. And I, you know, started to move further when I was younger. I started to move away from just making traditional furniture and really move more towards making art furniture. And that, in turn, led me to actually creating fine art pieces or more sculpture. I still like to carry that tradition with me of producing something that is utilitarian, like furniture. Part of the reason why I really want to continue that is, you know, in the tradition of all arts, art was produced out of a utilitarian need. It was not produced. People didn't produce art, you know, thousands of years ago just to hang on a wall to look beautiful. it had a meaning behind it. Even if you're talking about a cave painting, I mean, that was produced. That wasn't just to make the cave walls look great. It had a spiritual, utilitarian meaning behind it. And so I like to carry that through with all of my pieces. So the pieces that I do, even the two-dimensional works, have a utilitarian purpose in my mind. And so that theme I try to always carry into the work.
Yeah, I was thinking about, when you were talking, I was thinking about the Richard Wright. I'm not certain who Richard Wright was in conversation with. I don't know if it was Langston Hughes or, I'm not sure, it might have been Langston Hughes. Remember that conversation about art for art's sake?
Yeah.
And it sounds as if, you know, just from what you just said, but, you know, sometimes when people look at art, they don't know the function. I mean, it has a function, but they don't know what it is. So they appreciate, you know, its aesthetic value, and they might not necessarily know how to unpack it because, you know, it might not be for them. It might not be there. They might not be the audience, so they don't have the historic reference to be able to unpack it. So they get what they get because you get something out of it even if you don't know the utilitarian value of it, or what do you do, how do you wear it, you know, how do you sit in it,
yeah.
Carry it with you, who's in this piece. You might not know all of that because you might not be the audience, you might not have that kind of grounding.
Exactly.
So I was thinking about when you just said what you said.
Well, one thing too with my work, carrying that utilitarian theme, whenever I have exhibitions, I try to encourage people. Now, with this exhibition, I couldn't because all of the works are under glass and, you know, in cases. But with a lot of my other works, particularly if you come to my studio, I actually encourage people to actually touch the pieces, hold the pieces, put it in their hand. Because they are utilitarian, they're meant to have the human touch as a part of that. So by holding it, by touching it, you may not necessarily, like you said, recognize the themes or see a connection in it. But just by holding those pieces, you start to develop a connection. The other aspect is I love to use mirrors in my work. The reason why, for two reasons. Mirrors, to me, symbolize the reflections that people have, and it connects to water. And by seeing yourself in a reflection, whether or not you like a piece or not, or see no connection, you're in that piece whether you want to or not. So that's going to draw people in also.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was just thinking, I was looking at another one of your pieces. This particular figure, she has red lips, and her eyes are closed, and she looks like she's in, you know, some serious thought, or she was in some serious thought because she has these lines going across her forehead, and then the hair comes down, and then there's like this white sort of, like, I don't know if it's a scratch or what, on right on the side where her hair is, and then in the middle she has you know, one of those jewels that you put in your, where your third eye is, and this one here has a couple of red dots in a body of white, and it's like shaped like a drop of water or a teardrop. And then right below along her nose on the right side of your face in the piece, there's some more, you know, sort of shadows of the white. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that piece. And I was thinking about how, you know, with regards to the lines, they're like so lyrical and they kind of dance. And I was wondering, when you carve and when you put these pieces together, are you listening to music? What's your mood? What are you doing?
That's a great point. And I must say, I have to say this one thing. Wanda, you have a really great eye. And I love the fact that you study a piece and gather all of the details. That is really an amazing trait, and I love it. And I'm flattered that you really took this much time to study my work. To answer your question, that piece that you're describing sounds like the Mommy Water cabinet. That I made. And it is, yeah, it's a woman. She has that jewel, the bindi, which is placed in the center, which represents the third eye. And her eyes are closed. So she is in a meditative state. She's my thinking behind that piece, she was in this meditative state, very calm. The lines around her represent water, like the ripples in water. So you can imagine she's representing, in my mind, she's representing a calm body of water that's just there. It's in a meditative state. My parents used to always refer to this expression, still waters run deep. You know, people underestimate. They see really still water, and people may underestimate it and say, oh, well, you know, that's still water. Man, that's probably like just a couple of feet deep. And then they dive in, and they find out, my gosh, this was like a huge lake. But the water was yet so calm and seemed so tranquil, but yet it was so deep. And that's what she represents. She is this deep spirit. She's this deep mother that is so calm, but yet she has so much wisdom and so much depth to her that it – and with her, she's infinite. She's not just a couple of feet deep. She's, you know, an infinite amount of depth, if you use that as a symbol. Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. You your creative journey as a sculptural furniture artist, I guess, began at the Baltimore School for the Arts.
Mm-hmm.
And then you earned a BA in furniture building and design from the University of the Arts in Philadelphia, and an MFA from the University of Massachusetts at Dartmouth. And your work is are in the collection of various galleries and museums and featured in several major publications. You've studied karmic astrology and cartography, and that encourages you to produce the art that promotes healing. And you take a decidedly Eastern view in your choice of materials, colors, and methods of building and design. For example, you believe that the spirit and characteristics of materials lend themselves to a particular piece of art, and so you use recycled materials. That's a really important component of your work. I remember when I first met you, it was at the, Gallery 416 in Oakland? Is that the name? Is that the name?
Yes,
Yeah, right now they have this really wonderful exhibit up. I'm looking at Queen of Sheba out of Ethiopia. And you also, you're a businessman. You have St. Paul Art and Design Studio. And you've been one of the decidedly, I don't know if noisy would be the right word for it, but you've been, you know, really vocal around the disappearance of art, black art and artists from San Francisco. You've had a lot of shows, you know, at your gallery sort of promoting the artists that are still there.
We formed a collective. I'm one of the founders of a collective called 3.9,
right,
which is addresses the issues of the dwindling African American population in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about some of these pieces, but specifically about materials that you use. And I don't think you answered my question about how you you have this idea, and how do you go from idea to work? I mean, is spirit talking to you and saying, okay, pick up this, William, and pick up that, and you know, I mean, like, do you have a drawing? I mean, how do you do what you do?
No, that's a good point, and I'm sorry.
Maybe talk. Maybe talk about one piece and then sort of go from idea to work, and we can look for that when we go to the exhibit at the library.
So, for example, with the piece that you had described, and I had mentioned the Mommy Water cabinet, that piece started off as literally a vision. And it sounds really cliche, but I'm being perfectly honest with anyone that's listening. Lately, there have been moments that ideas come to me in such a strong way, particularly when I'm asleep at night. 3-4 o'clock in the morning, I get hit with these ideas, and it literally hits me so hard sometimes I have to get out of bed. I mean, it will wake me out of a cold sleep. That is no exaggeration. And this has increased, I would say, within the past 3 to 4 years. These ideas coming to you like that has increased considerably. So her vision came to me in the middle of the night. I jumped up, did a basic little kind of a sketch or just write out my ideas, wrote it out on paper. Then I, several days later, took that idea, sat down in my studio, started doing some drawings. And a lot of times what I like to do, I actually work full size, life size. So I may actually take a large piece of paper, do a full-scale drawing of the piece like Mommy Water. Then I will take the wood, pieces of wood, and I will lay it out or trace this large-scale drawing, trace it directly on the Mommy Water, on the pieces of wood. And so it becomes like a pattern. And then I start to cut it out. I have various tools, jigsaws, different things that I use. I'll cut out the rough shapes, and then I go back in with a tool that's called a grinder, a right-angle grinder. An example, a lot of people may know what this is, but if you don't know what a right-angle grinder is, it's when you see guys using grinding a car, like, and you see sparks flying. They have this tool, and they're grinding the metal on a car. It's the same principle, but you could put sandpaper, wood sandpaper wheels on it, and you could use it the same way. So you can grind the wood really quickly to get the shapes that you want. And then I go back in and do more carving to get more details. And then I'll cut little window, like little areas out in the wood, and that becomes like my little niches or kind of spaces that I can pop my mirrors in. Once I pop my mirrors in, then I can go back in and add color, more details, and add, you know, other details. Like I may build a little section where I can put my drawers in, because this piece has drawers that pull out. And all of the materials, as far as the wood is usually recycled or just found wood. I take walks sometimes in my neighborhood. In San Francisco, and if I see a nice piece of wood that's laying on the street, because people set some amazing things out on the street, or it could be a chair, or it could be a table, then that wood is going to be the wood that's going to be used in my work. And the same with mirrors. Broken mirrors, I have friends that give me mirrors all the time. Eventually those pieces of mirror will get incorporated in my work. So that's pretty much the process. And as far as music, lately I have been my music choices really vary. I mean, I sometimes, if I'm in a mood, I'll have incredibly soft, relaxing music. It could be jazz, it can be pop pieces, R&B. But lately I've been listening to a musician by the name of Sun Ra.
Wow.
And he has a song called Disco 3000, which is this, it's an amazing song, crazy, exciting. The thing I like about Sun Ra, when I'm working on a piece of art, and you listen to Sun Ra's music, his music is so unpredictable. You get into a rhythm, you're working a certain way, and this is unconscious. And you're in a certain pace or rhythm when you're carving. And then he will just change. His music will go in a completely different direction. And it feels like there is no connection to what he originally started with. But then he works his way back around. For all of the listeners out there, I would suggest take a look at Sun Ra. I mean, his music is just, it's different, more, it's way out there. I mean, beyond anything you may have heard.
Yeah, I was looking at your website, and I think I was in your gallery, and I was looking at the gallery is in your former studio, right? Because this says Baltimore, and you're in San Francisco.
Yeah.
So is your current studio sort of patterned after the Baltimore site?
It totally is. It totally is. In my house in Baltimore, for example, in my house in Baltimore, I have an area where I had murals painted, and I actually now have that same, a similar mural painted in my house in San Francisco. But that serves not so much as just a studio space, but it actually is as a altar space for my ancestors, where I keep pictures, photographs, memorabilia, various things that remind me of my ancestors that are around me. Also, the layout of the space, I tried to pattern that in some ways with Baltimore. They're both similar in age houses. My house in Baltimore was built like in 1890s, and the house here is early, it was built after the Great Earthquake, so like 1907. So similar period. So there's a lot of connections in both places.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then, I was looking at your jazz series. Really, really beautiful, beautiful work.
Thank you.
And then your new Voodoo series, it's really intriguing, talking about, that New Orleans connection. So who in your family is from Louisiana, New Orleans?
They are, they're pretty fascinating people. I lost my connection with them, but and that's one thing I have to really try to reconnect with my family. But they were involved in, or are involved in, the funeral business.
Seriously?
They actually, which is quite a bizarre, but fascinating business to be in. But they have been involved in that, I think, for years, for many, many years. And through my grandfather, that was where the connection came from. My grandfather, who lived to be 103, when he passed, unfortunately, the connection that I had with that side of the family, I lost it. When he passed, we sold his house, cleared out all of his things. That connection was pretty much lost. But that's one thing I have to reconnect with them. But I do know they're still out there. They exist. And so that's why when that Hurricane Katrina hit, it was, I took it very personal and felt a strong connection to that.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, so I was just thinking, the whole series, Voodoo, and I was thinking about the funeral business. I'm thinking about, the Orisha of the winds, and also she's also one of the guardians of the cemetery.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was wondering if you could talk a bit about, your travels. You mentioned that you were in southern part of the Americas, and
mm-hmm.
I presume Salvador, Bahia, and there Yemanja, is highly venerated because like here we are in the San Francisco Bay Area, the water is really close to us. You can't go anywhere and not see the bay.
I know.
The bay, the ocean. I mean, it's all around us, as well as, the trees and the mountains or the hills, depending on where you are. But the water is like sort of can't ignore it. And similarly in Salvador, very similar to the Bay Area, right on the water. And so this past Sunday, there's the big ritual honoring, Yemanja, sort of the mother of the waters and humanity. I was wondering if you could talk a bit about your travels there, because I was just there in Salvador. I just got back about 3 weeks ago.
Wow. I love Salvador, by the way. I'm in an amazing, amazing place in Bahia. The energy there, and the people there, I went a long time ago. I haven't been there since the 90s. But when I was there, I felt an immediate connection. I mean, it felt like going home for me. And as far as the connection with the mother water goddesses, I feel you feel her energy, you know, during the time of New Year's where people actually put offerings to her and send it out on the ocean, you know, like little boats. You'll see that. So just seeing that is amazing. And then the thing that just really struck me was the fact, you know, growing up in the States, particularly, you know, when I was a kid, I'm at the 60s, 70s, and 80s, it just, to see or to really talk about anything other than strict Catholicism was almost blasphemy where I grew up in Baltimore in some ways. Especially during that time. I mean, people are a lot more open now than they used to be. But when I walked around Salvador and you would go into shops or go into people's businesses and you would see little statues of the Mother Goddess next to, you know, their Catholic statues of their saints or whatever. But she was incorporated into the daily life, and I just found that so amazing. And growing up in the States, too, particularly in my environment, I mean, I grew up with one side of my family Catholic, the other side strongly Baptist. So it was always a fear that if you go outside of that, that, you know, you're immediately going to hell and it's demonic or evil. And to see this respect for the Mother Goddess, and it wasn't a fear around that. It wasn't that she's evil or she's destructive or, oh, you better be careful worshiping her or being connected with her. It was a reverence to her and incorporating her along with the other belief systems. So I just felt that just absolutely amazing. And you could feel that with the people, the warmth, the love of the people, at least back then, was just unlike anything I'd ever experienced.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, yeah, it's still there. And I was just thinking, you know, with regards to your work, since your work, you know, you deal with the elements. You know, wood is a natural, you know, occurring element, and then, you know, the glass, what goes, you know, how we make glass, you know, from sand. And you think about the other parts of, you know, the other elements of your work, sort of connect us to what's natural, you know, the water, the earth, you know, whether it's thematic or actual, you know, something tangible in your various art pieces. We've got the air, and we have fire, and we have what is below, and what is above, and what is within, and you sort of like tie it all together. You know, with these works that make us do these different turns and spins, and as we contemplate how we're connected, you know, to the elements.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Really, really, really beautiful. So we've been talking, and I don't think we gave people like the details about how they can see this art, so that they won't miss it today.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's the show is Souls of Water, Memories of the African Diaspora. The exhibition closes on the 6th, and it's at the main San Francisco Public Library in the African American Center, African American Center, and it's on the third floor. It's absolutely free, so please stop by. The address of the San Francisco Public Library is 100 Larkin Street at Grove, and the phone number there is 415-557-4277.
Okay, and that's really great that that the possibility of a catalog is really imminent. So 4277, you said for the library.
Yes, can I repeat it again?
Oh, yeah, please.
So the phone number is 415-557-4277, San Francisco
right.
Public Library.
Right, and that's 100 Larkin Street. And
correct.
The library, I believe, is open in the morning. I don't know what time in the morning. Is it open at 10 or 9? Or?
I think it depends on the days. I would suggest for our callers to call in and check because certain days it opens, I think, at 10, and then there are other days I think it opens at 12, but I'm not sure
right.
which days they are.
Yeah, and I think Thursday the library is open late.
Okay. Yeah, that does
yeah.
sound
it
right.
It opens in the evening on one of the days, and I think tomorrow is our lucky day.
Oh, good.
So,
okay.
Yeah. Well, it's great because if you're closing, then people can go and stay for a while.
Yes. Live with the work. You know, I said, please, you know, take your time. There's about 10 pieces in the show, so, you know, please take your time just like Wanda would do, which, like I said, I love that. Study the work. If it's something that you don't understand or whatever, you know, try to study it. And one thing also I tell people, if there's something in the work that makes you uncomfortable, then that's a good thing, because I want you to really ask yourself, well, why do I feel this way around the work? And just like if something makes you feel really good about the work, you know, ask yourself that question. What is it that really makes me feel good about this piece? And that's really the whole purpose of having this exhibition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You say in your artist statement that your work explores themes of hidden knowledge, iconographic imagery, and forms and how they can change meaning in a given cultural context. So that's
mm-hmm.
interesting. You know, like if you know, hopefully you better take this exhibit and travel it, and it'll be really cool to see, well, what comes up for people in Bahia.
Yeah.
Around this imagery. Wouldn't that be cool? And what comes up for people in Senegal around this imagery? Wouldn't that be neat?
I would love it. I mean, that would be a dream, and I would totally be open to that idea.
Yeah, and just like, you know, when you do your artist talk and people ask questions, just to see, you know, sort of some of the similarities and differences in the conversation. So you had an artist talk this past weekend. What came
mm-hmm.
up for people when they were talking to you about the work? And what was different about their reception and their perceptions that you maybe had, and you were like, wow, I didn't see that in the piece? Because I know as an artist, you don't, you know, when you make your art, when you create your art, you're not thinking, I'm going to put this in it. It's just, you know, that's not how it happens.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But then people get things out of it that make you see it as the creator or as the vehicle for the creation. Because, you know, some people say, I was just the vehicle. You know, spirit was just coming through me. You know, you
yeah.
get a chance to appreciate it in different ways.
The artist talk went really well. I had a great group of people that attended the artist talk. They, to answer your question, some of the things that came up, one thing that came up, which I was excited about, I didn't even have to say it, and people brought it up themselves. They talked about how talking about water to them was a symbol of how we are all interconnected. And I heard that from several people, and I was so excited to hear that, because they got it, and I didn't have to preach it or say it. They totally got the connection, and they knew that the work, although on the surface we're talking about, you know, the connection of people of the African diaspora, that is one level, but I must tell you, and they got this, that this exhibition talking about water is the connection of all of us. It's not just people that focus on the African diaspora. It's everyone. One analogy that I used when I did my artist talk this weekend was the analogy that what I'm hoping that our society will start to understand, and this is everyone from young to old, is that basically we're in a system that's based on cause and effect. So basically the actions that you do, what are the ripple effects that they cause, whether positive or negative? So the analogy would be you have a pond of water and you put little paper boats on the top of the water, and then someone comes with a rock and they throw the rock down, and it could be, you know, several feet away from these boats. It could be quite a distance away from the boats, but just by throwing that rock in that water, it causes ripples, and it affects those little boats floating on the water. And I'm hoping that that the show will really give the feeling and let people understand that, we can't continue to play the game where it's like we cage people off and feel like, well, if this group of people are unhealthy and if they don't want to change or they're going to do X, Y, and Z, then we're just going to cage them off and that'll fix our problem. The actions that we do, no matter how far away we are going to affect everyone, cause and effect. And we're seeing that on a global scale whenever we watch television and everything else. All of these events affect everyone. And so I was just so happy that people walked away with that and brought that up themselves. I'm trying to think of what came up that was surprising that they mentioned in my work that I did not see. I'm trying to remember, was there any comments? Not so much things that I didn't – they didn't bring up anything that was real that I had not seen before. But I think I was just really happy and excited over the fact that they had such strong personal connections to the work. You know, I had a couple of people say that, oh, your portrait of your dad, he looks like someone in my family. You know, that made me feel really good. They felt strong connections with that. So I think that's pretty much what I took away from the exhibition, how the lecture went. Did I answer your question?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, definitely, definitely. I want to let everyone know we're speaking to William Rose about Souls of Water, Memories of African Diaspora, his current exhibit, which is up through February 6th, which is tomorrow, at the African American Center, third floor at the San Francisco Main Library, 100 Larkin Street at Grove. And the phone number there is area code 415-557-4277. And you definitely don't want to miss this great exhibition because everything that William Rose does is certainly worth a gander.
Thank you.
Yeah. Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. Just really, just your work is just always so striking. And it always, you know, we know you walk into a gallery, oh, yeah, that's a William Rose piece. I mean, it's just like, you know that is yours. And I was just thinking as you know, you were speaking and just reflecting on some of the work of yours that I've seen over the years, you know, that usually there's an element of flight and movement, but literal flight, like something's always flying in your exhibits. You know, I don't know if it has wings or it's just the way, you know, you assemble it, or the way, you know, the way that it's presented, but there's always an element of flight. So is anything flying? Because I haven't seen all the 10 pieces. Is anything flying in this exhibit?
Well, that's a very good point. There is definitely movement. I have to tell you, there is a lot of movement in the work. Not literally flying in this work,
okay.
But it's definite movement. And I'm glad you picked that up. That movement, you know, I guess giving a feeling of flight is really talking about, you know, the spirit, you know, how the spirit moves, the direction that the spirit travels, and really our minds, our conscious minds or unconscious minds, where that travels, where that moves. That's what a lot of that movement is about. And the movement of water. In this particular exhibition, the movement of water and how, again, you know, people underestimate water. This is a side note, I wanted to mention this.
Mm-hmm.
I started doing a lot of research around, like I mentioned, when Hurricane Katrina came about. I started doing research, and I found this is very fascinating. When you look at the Chinese symbols of the elements, it's very fascinating that when they talk about people of the African diaspora, they fall under the category of water. Now, mind you, I want this to be made very clear for any listener. All humans are connected and have a variety of elements with them. So it's not like one specific group is one element. We all have those elements. But if you want to talk about, if you want to generalize or talk about a concentration, people of the African diaspora fall under the water element. And when I read about the Chinese symbols and they talked about these elements, they said that with water, the water element could be considered as pretty benign, but in actuality is the most powerful, or one of the most powerful of all the elements. And I think about how amazing it is with water. You can have just the most subtle stream going across rocks, which is rocks are considered a super strong element. And over time, that subtle movement of that water around that rock will change the shape of that rock and will cut into that rock. But it's so subtle, and if you didn't really watch it or pay attention, you would never know that that water would have that much strength and that much power to change things like that. So to answer your question, I'm talking about that too with the movement and that subtle change that has so much power in it, but it's done over a period of time. It doesn't happen right away. It could take 100 years, it could take 1,000 years, but it does make that change, and it makes major changes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I was thinking as you were talking, I was thinking about transport and, you know, across the waters. I was thinking about water, you know, having multiple forms. I mean, it can be liquid, it can be gas, it can be solid, depending on sort of, you know, whether or not the air around it is really cold and it freezes, you know. Or that, you know, sometimes it's really hot and it turns into gas, it joins the air. So it's like, I don't know of any of the other elements that have a variety of ways to come. Like, I can come this way, I can come that way. So it kind of changes up on you, and you're like, oh.
Yeah, it is.
It's like, mm-hmm, yeah, being real versatile and being able to adapt. And that's like us as a people. And then I think about freedom, you know, and tenacity and how, you know, liberation, you know, water, the way it moves, you know, water is about one of the freest of the elements.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, you know, fire is free, but fire can't move like water moves. You know, fire, you know when it's there because it destroys stuff or it transforms things. But water would just be like sleeping along, just like chilling and moving all the time. Just, you know, it's like, I'm just chilling, but it's like moving. And you look up like, oh, my goodness, how'd you get down there? How'd you get up there? How'd you get over there?
Exactly.
Because it's like, as it's moving, it's not, like you say, the change doesn't happen immediately all the time. So it can be moving, and then all of a sudden you look up, it's like, it's everywhere. And the whole set is, like, different. And you didn't even know it. You didn't see it coming real quick.
No.
Real subtle.
It's very subtle. You know, you mentioned when you read my bio, and I don't know if you want me to mention this or talk about this, but how my astrology kind of plays into it.
Definitely. Mm-hmm.
It to me, it's also fascinating. You know, I study the art of astrology, and one period that we're in right now is something, and I'd like all the listeners, if you're interested, please Google this and read up on it. You know, just don't take my word for it. Read up on this yourself. There's a theme that we're in right now, the planet, and it's called Neptune in Pisces. And Neptune and Pisces, we're in it for a long time. I mean, it's like, I want to say like 10 to 20 years we're going to be in it. It hit like 2012, the planet Neptune going into Pisces. And what that means is it's a period of amazing water qualities, which means emotions, a period of psychic abilities, incredible creativity, also escapism. That's the other part of it. And the last time that we saw Neptune in Pisces was right before the Civil War. And during that time, there was it was an amazing time. I mean, it was horrible in many respects, particularly for people of the African diaspora. But when that Neptune in Pisces hit back then, the book Uncle Tom's Cabin was written, and also the book 12 Years as a Slave.
Really?
Yeah, that was the last time Neptune was in Pisces, and that was a period where people began to start to question and say, wait a minute, what is the rights of humans? is it fair the way we're treating people? Are we treating people in a just and kind way based on the fact that slavery was still rocking and rolling at that point? And you see where eventually it led to the Civil War. But it's just so fascinating that we're in Neptune and Pisces now. And I'm watching all of these movies come out, 12 Years as a Slave, and then it was Django, and, you know, and it just hit now. But, you know, again, I'm, you know, with this work and with my thinking, I'm hoping that we're going to get to a point where we're going to start to say, well, wait a minute. Are we thinking of the human condition for all people, not just ourselves, because we're afraid or because of fear that we're going to lose something, but are we really moving forward? You know, if we say that we're in a post-racial society, are we really including everyone, and do we listen to everybody's opinion and think it's valid? Not just based on our opinion where we say, oh, yeah, things are better, and we are, you know, living in an ivory tower, but are we looking at everybody's thoughts and opinions? You know, that is really Neptune and Pisces. I think that's one of the heights of that. And I think in the coming years, that is going to come to the forefront even more during this period. So when I was producing this work, I was thinking about that too. That's Neptune and Pisces.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's really interesting. You know, the sort of cyclical nature of things, because if the last time Neptune was in Pisces, it was right before the Civil War, and we're at war, and supposedly the wars are supposed to be ending, but those questions around, you know, human rights and the rights of the people there, you know, what happened in North Africa and also the Middle East, and sort of some of the questions that particularly the young people are asking. You know, we think about, you know, Oscar Grant and Trayvon Martin and, you know, and other young people who have been killed. And then we think about, you know, this other people that are just able to just kill African people of African descent, and not suffer any consequences. You know, the man who killed Trayvon Martin, you know, the man who shot that young man in the service station. It's like those questions have not been resolved, and here they are.
They haven't. And water's gonna bring up those questions even more. It's gonna keep coming. And also, you know, water energy is, if you want to classify it, again, I don't want to generalize, but if you want to classify it, it is a feminine energy. Mm-hmm. And being a feminine energy, there are certain aspects that deal with the mother and deal with women's rights, deals with, you know, the creator of everything, you know, comes out of a feminine energy. It does not come out of a masculine aspect only. You can't, or does not come out of that. That's feminine energy. And so issues around, like you said, like you talked about, you know, people having the right to just kill a person based on the color of their skin, and also people having the right to take somebody's rights away and make decisions for a person based on the fact that she's a woman or she's considered weaker or less than, or, you know, being in a society that's just male-dominated. Those are things that are going to have to come up too, and we're going to have to look at that as well. Not just the color. The color is a huge aspect of it, but also the feminine aspects do have to be addressed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then, you know, sort of the whole thing, you know, your souls of water, memories of the African diaspora, but the souls of water part, you think about water. Water doesn't have a color, but we think it does. You know, we think it's blue, we think it's green, you know, we think it's yellow. But it's colorless, and it's odorless, and, you know, unless it has a whole lot of minerals, and it's not the water, it's the minerals, it's tasteless. So it's like, wow, that's kind of interesting. But we project these things, you know, into and on the water. And then water also is so receptacle for a lot of things we want to get rid of. You know, we think about evolution. We think about cleaning ourselves, and then where does the stuff go? It goes in the water.
And so,
you know, you talk about how water is like major healing, you know, like the mother goddess energy, because water can like take it it could take it all and it could, you know, absorb it, and then through a various processes that only, you know, it and the Creator knows, you know, be able to keep on flourishing and keep on being that place where we can get our sustenance sometimes. But then, you know, with the technological age and the industrial age that we're in, it's getting harder and harder for these bodies, this body of water, because it's all connected, to be able to break down these things that we're throwing into it.
Yeah.
So we see it coming back at us. So maybe you know, on a metaphysical or philosophical, you know, way of thinking about this, those ideas and these problems that have not been resolved, you know, we think, you know, pre-Civil War, and that's over 100 years ago, like 150-something years ago. It's not resolved yet. So because it's still on the water, here it is again, right?
Yep. It washes out, you know, you throw it out, you know, you know, when it's low tide, and then when it's high tide, it brings it right back in. And that's the nature of our, you know, this society that we live in. Again, not seeing the connection in anything and feeling like you could just push things under a rug or you can just cage something off and it's going to resolve the problem. It never does.
Yeah.
It never does.
Yeah, and that's a good thing. You know, it's a good thing
that
water behaves the way it does, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It does.
Yeah. That's a very good thing. And it's been so good, you know, having you on the show. And so lastly, I wanted to ask you, you mentioned in your artist statement that, you know, going back to your travels, that the people, art, and cultures of these societies in Africa, Asia, Central, South America, you know, not to mention, you know, your own country, you know, North America, have inspired you to consider non-traditional approaches to art and sculpture. And I was wondering if you could maybe give us an example of this, you know, in your current exhibition.
Using things, well, you know, spending time in, I mean, I've gotten inspiration from so many places, whether it be Guatemala, whether it be even the Philippines, they do this, and parts of Africa. You know, I spent time recently with the Maasai people in Tanzania. They do this, what I'm about to mention. They actually have certain spiritual objects. They may take something that is from an ancestor and incorporate that into something that they use. You know, that's done throughout, you know, Asia, South America, and Africa, you know, where they take it. And that, so that's a practice that I really got from, you know, the indigenous people of these locations. I took with one of the pieces that I mentioned about with the Bible, my father's Bible, and I created that case, a box around it, that has buttons and elements from my father when my father was alive. My father died about 10 years ago. So those, they are incorporated into the work. That stone that I mentioned from Goree Island, that's another thing infused into the piece. So it's not just producing just a piece that is made to just look good, but these elements become a part of the piece, which gives it a certain amount of energy and power and reverence. And also, it does have a decorative element as well, but it's way beyond just the decorative element.
Yeah. Wow. Ah, you're just remarkable. And, oh.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, I said one question, but then I definitely want you to be able to talk a little bit in closing about the children that you work with. Yeah, I wanted you to tell us about your work with these wonderful children in the Bayview Hunters Point, at the Bayview Opera House, the Dare to Dream program. Yeah, tell us about that a little bit.
So Dare to Dream is at the Bayview Opera House. It's a wonderful after-school program and also a artistic enhancement program. As you know, or as the listeners probably know, a lot of the schools started stop offering arts programs, or they had limited arts programs. So Dare to Dream provided a lot of art enrichment programs. So I'm currently working with Dr. Charles Drew, which is a elementary school, and we're working on a African-American history quilt. So each student, this is our current project, each student is given a square, it's like a little patch, and larger than a size of paper. The square is made out of recycled rubber, so it has a really interesting feel, and the kids actually, we talk about a specific historic figure in Black history, and they actually produce a piece of artwork on that square of what they're taught. They're encouraged to write. They're encouraged to do drawings, mixed media, paint, and then we do a basic sewing technique, real basic peyote stitch around it, and then after all of the squares are completed, we haven't completed it yet, but once all the squares are completed, we're going to sew them all together, and we're going to create a huge quilt, which is a Black History Month quilt. So I don't know if I answered your question, but that's kind of where what I'm working on now with the kids.
Nice. Where are you going to display it at the Bayview Opera House?
That's one of the locations, and then afterwards it's going to go back to the school.
Oh, nice. Oh, well, definitely let me know once you all finish and it's up. I want to see it.
And I will keep you posted. I don't want to talk about it too much yet. But it could be a possibility that I'm really working on all of the groundwork trying to figure this out, but there could be a possibility that this quilt idea could actually take on a more of an international flair. Not this specific quilt, but I'm working on an international quilt project, and I'm hoping that could come to fruition. And if it does, I will definitely, you'll be one of the first to hear about it.
Oh, thank you. It's really interesting. There are so many quilts, maybe because it's more than stitching. Actually, it's a coded language within the pattern, within the colors that, you know, this particular form of communication that is being passed down to the young people is really great because it's definitely a cultural inheritance that could be lost if children don't learn about, you know, these story quilts. And there's an exhibit at George Gordon Gallery. There's an exhibit in Sacramento. And you know, now you talk about, you know, these young people are making this quilt in Bayview, Hunters Point, you know, at the Opera House. That is so wonderful.
Yeah, it's exciting. Yeah. And the kids seem like they're really into it, too, which to me is the most important thing.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah, you know, using our hands, you know, making something beautiful and something utilitarian and something practical and something you can sleep under.
Yes.
Yeah, that's really great. Wow, William, it's been so wonderful talking to you today. This is like, we've had like an hour-long conversation, really extended.
It's been amazing. And actually, I'm going to have to go because I have to teach a class. I have to work with the kids that I was just talking about.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for the conversation. I'm definitely going to get over before it closes. It's really kind of wonderful that it's closing on Bob Marley's birthday.
Wow, I didn't know that. That is great.
Yeah. Well, you take good care. Looking forward to seeing you in the community and to seeing this wonderful work currently up at the African American Center at the San Francisco May Library.
Oh, thank you so much. And it has definitely been a pleasure being on your show.
Anytime.
Well, thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. You take good care.
Okay, take good care.
All right, bye-bye. Yeah. So that was artist William Rhodes, and lucky, wonderful to talk to him about Souls of Water, Memories of African Diaspora. And before we close our program with a rebroadcast of a wonderful interview we had this past Friday, January 31st, with the two programmers and founders of Black Choreographers Festival Here and Now, which starts this Sunday, February 9th at Yerba Buena Center for the Arts at the 50 Cent Tabernacle. You'll be able to take sample wonderful, wonderful classes, dance classes for just 50 cents. Like, can you beat that? No, you cannot. And the festival actually runs through March 8th. So it's going to be at four different venues. It's going to be at Yerba Buena Center for the Arts. It's going to be at Dance Mission, you know, a longtime collaborator with Black Choreographers Festival. It's going to be at Laney College, another longtime collaborator with Black Choreographers. And it's going to be at ODC Theater, another venue that we've seen Black Choreographers Festival and their year-long programs that they've supported there. I also want to mention that the Dance Brigade Hemorrhage, An Evolution of Hope and Despair, a dance installation at the intersection of the new San Francisco and world politics, is continuing through February 8th this year at Dance Mission. So it's closing this weekend, so you don't want to miss it. It's Thursday, Friday, Saturday at 8 p.m. and Sunday at 6 p.m. And Dance Mission, again, is at 3316 24th Street at Mission in San Francisco. And for information, you can visit dancemission.com or call 415-826-4441. And you can buy your tickets at brownpapertickets.com or 800-838-3006. And you probably noticed that our show is broadcasting at 7 in the morning, Pacific time. So we're going to continue this time. I don't need to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning anymore. I'm not teaching an early, early class. So we're gonna go with this 7 o'clock time. But keep posted. Keep yourself tuned in. And I'm going to play a song by Ben Vereen that I really love. I've got a lot of living to do, and we certainly do, don't we? And then we're going to shift right into the interview with Laura Elaine Ellis, Kendra Kimbrough Barnes, and choreographer, they're all choreographers, but choreographer Gregory Dawson, speaking about the 10th anniversary of Black Choreographers Festival Here and Now.
Remember me telling you about these guys who ran Vegas? Well, they had a theme song. They were cool. Frank, Dino, Joey, Peter, Sammy Davis Jr. They all smoked Lucky cigarettes because they knew they were the luckiest guys on the planet. And they had a theme song. And the theme song went like this. There are girls just right for some kissing. And I mean to kiss me a few. Oh, those girls don't know what they're missing. I've got a lot of living to do. And there is one. such a lot of living to do. There are places to go, people to see, things we should do. There is everything for me and you. Last of all, if only you know it, and it's all waiting for you. Girl, you're alive. Come on and show it. Oh, there's such a lot of living, such a lot of living, such a lot of living to do.
Good morning and welcome to Wanda's Ticks, the Black Arts and Culture Program of the African Sisters Media Network. We are so excited to have some of our special guests on again. It's time for the Black Choreographers Festival Here and Now, and it's in anticipation of its 10th anniversary. Is this your 10th anniversary, Kendra?
It sure is. Yes, we are super excited about that.
Oh, my God. I remember the first one, and we have so many great interviews. Oh my goodness! Over the years, just sort of looking at the development of this wonderful, wonderful annual ritual festival, and we are joined in the studio with one of the founders of African American Black Choreographers Festival Here and Now. We're joined by one of my favorite dancers. I've seen you on stage lots of times, Gregory Dawson. But I never had an opportunity to see you. And when I looked at your picture, I'm like, oh, I know his work. Oh, my God, this is so exciting. Yeah. So I want to maybe introduce you first, Kendra, and then you could give us some of the background and history of this wonderful festival, Black Choreographers Festival Here and Now, and the organization that you have created, and you're also a well-known choreographer as well, with your company, and Laura Elaine Ellis, Executive Director of the African-American Performing Arts Coalition, APAC, and then so wonderful how, we don't just see you in February and maybe March, but, Black Choreographers is hosting and being part of performing arts to the Pan-African diaspora throughout the year. I mean, in master classes and, sort of presenting some of your artists in full evening works that we saw a little snippet of, in February.
Mm-hmm.
It was just really wonderful. So Kendra Kimbrough Barnes is the director and holds a BA in dance from San Francisco State University and an MA in arts administration from Golden Gate University. She graduated with honors and is a recipient of the Who's Who Among Students in American Universities and Colleges Award. And as of 2008, the Who's Who Among American Women. Wow, so we got to have a Who's Who in 2014, huh? Keep it going. aspiring to be a choreographer at age 7 and beginning classes at age 12, she has studied a variety of styles, including contemporary, African, Brazilian, Indian, and Dunham and Horton techniques. She has also performed with such notables as the late Malanga Costalor's Hua, the Akongo, Trish
Das.
Trish yes. Das.
Uh-huh.
Keep on going. I don't know how to pronounce the next one word either.
Kathak Dance Company.
Yeah. Yadama Bird, Robert Moses, Robert Henry Johnson, B.B. Miller, Bill T. Jones, and Rose Angela Silvestre. Kendra has been guest choreographer for San Francisco State University's Dance Department, Dimensions Extensions Youth Performance Ensemble, MOVE Dance Theater of Oakland, and Abundant Life Christian Fellowship. She's the resident choreographer for all major productions there. In 1996, she founded the Kendra Kimbrough Dance Ensemble, KKDE, which has presented work at the East Bay Dance Festival, Alice Arts Center, the Black Choreographers Festival, Summerfest, West Wave Dance Festival, and Dance Mosaic. Kendra currently teaches dance to adults and children ages 7/18 through Dimensions Rites of Passage Program in Oakland at the Malanga Castellar Center for the Arts, and jazz, Pilates, yoga at San Mateo and Laney Colleges. So, Kendra, that was nice. Nice introduction to you, and I just want to mention a few of my... Oh, here's your... Here is your... Your co-director, Laura. Good morning, Laura. How
good
are
morning.
You?
Good morning.
Good morning. Hi, Kendra. Hi, Gregory. Hi, Wanda. Thanks for having us
on. Hi, hi. So, might as well introduce you, Laura, and then let you both talk about the festival, and then let you both introduce Gregory, and because you know, Kendra, your baby is sleeping, and we want to make sure we get the most out of you before that happens. But I just want to mention you. One of my favorite pieces you've done, Kendra, is when you did that wonderful honoring of your mother and sort of the matrilineal ancestry. It was so beautiful.
Oh,
and
thank you.
I think your daughter was still inside of you at that time. I think she was still not born yet when that was going on, when you did that piece.
Right, yeah, that was before Zara.
yeah, so that was like, it was the symbolism, but the costumes and the dance, it was just, and you were in it as well as the choreographer. It was just so magnificent. I wanted to say that because it sort of came to mind.
Oh, thank you. I was just going to just piggyback on that really quickly and say that it's interesting you brought that up because that is what inspired the piece that I will be bringing to the festival. I just kind of felt like my work with ancestry wasn't finished, so we're going to be carrying that out through the story of migrations within the company. So I just wanted to say that.
Oh, wow, nice. You mean you have something as a part of Black Choreographers Festival this year?
We do. We'll be showing on Friday, February 28th, yes, with Gregory and Portia and Joanna. Mm-hmm. Just on the Friday, February 28th.
Oh, you're dancing in Kendra's piece, too.
No, he's not dancing in my piece. No.
Oh, Gregory's
right. I'm saying we'll be sharing
on the same day.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
No.
Okay,
gotcha.
Let me clarify.
We'll think about that.
Okay, Laura, Elaine Ellis.
All right, love that.
Okay, that sounds good. Laura Elaine Ellis is executive director, as we already mentioned, of APAC, a San Francisco-based nonprofit organization, founded in 1995 by a collective artists who were looking to create better performance opportunities for African and African-American performing artists, as well as produce shows that reflect the aesthetic and cultural representation of the African and African-American experience. As APAC's executive director, Arlene Ellis has co-produced successful events such as the Labor of Love Dance Series, the Quilt Project, Pieces of Me, and is now celebrating 10 years of co-presenting the Black Choreographers Festival Here and Now. So welcome, Laura, again.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah.
All right, Greg, we haven't forgotten you, but we're going to let these two ladies talk about the festival. Okay, cool. And, Laura, I just want to mention that it's been a minute, but I really liked your piece you did as a part of the Afro Solo solo performances. That was just really striking, and I still resonate with it. I forgot the name of it, but it was really beautiful.
Oh, yeah, thank you. That piece was an invite from Thomas Simpson, who we adore. He also supports the festival in such a huge way. He wanted me to do something to the Nina Simone piece for women.
Mm-hmm.
So that is me. I considered the characters that are in that song and felt that as a black woman, I hold all of those in myself.
Mm-hmm.
So the I that is we is all of the women that are, you know, described so beautifully and profoundly in Nina Simone's piece for women. So it was a very abstract version of that song. And then I actually eliminated the song and partnered with Martha Muti Joseph, who, of course, part of the festival, and Kamara Dixon with visuals, and Ajay Destin, who's been a part of the festival as well, to create original music, because Kamara actually did music and the video, the media part or portion of it. Marco Muti wrote amazing language text that went along with Ajay and Kumar's original score. So that was really exciting to mm-hmm. do that piece.
Yeah.
And, of course, Thomas Simpson was like, okay, so where's the Nina Simone piece that I I was like, oh, Thomas, you did not think I was just going to take that song that 10 million other choreographers have taken and just do a solo to it. Did you really get that starting point? Now I got a piece. Now I have a 20-minute piece, right, that you can, you know, because her work inspired me to then say something that I wanted to say about my experience as a black woman. Which mm-hmm. was really surprising to this presenter who thought he was just going to get a little 5 minute solo to Nina Simone song. enough about that. But it's interesting in the context of a curator, and I know Kendra believes this too. I think one of the reasons the festival resonates so strongly with choreographers, being a choreographer, festival, is that we both do create and we understand the freedom that artists need and the opportunity, of course, that the festival provides. But a lot of folks, you know, they often ask us, like, what is that person doing or how are you curating it? And we're like, well, we don't really have a strong hand on the curation. We research and understand where the artist is coming from. We provide a venue, an appropriate venue, hopefully, for that work so it is framed well. And then we ask the artist, what do you want to bring? Because that's what really feeds an artist's process. They have to be free to bring something that is serving their purpose and their growth and their vision. Our vision has to be a little bit broader. It has to be about what is impactful to the community and serves the artist best. And I have to say, I think that we do that the way we do, and I feel we've done it pretty doggone successfully over the last 10 years because we're working artists ourselves. Kendra, you want to chime in on anything? Or did I?
No, you
about
said that.
Do you agree?
I absolutely agree. You said that very well, and you know, I think that's been a part of our vision from year one in our planning sessions before year one, is to really, you know, feed the artists and provide them a space to present what they're inspired to present that year. And we trust the artists. We know what they are capable of, and we were able to give them a venue or provide them with a venue to do that. So it's been very thrilling to see their work, you know, each time that we've invited folks. We are just as excited and surprised sometimes, you know, as audiences are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, this year the festival kicks off February 9th and it extends through March 8th, and it's in a variety of venues. You have a partnership with Yerba Buena Center for the Arts, which you have extended this time. Actually, the festival opens there in San Francisco, and you've got this thing called the 50 Cent Tabernacle. That sounds really interesting. And you're opening with classes and things like that, Mark featuring Mark Bermuthi, Joseph, Nora, how do you pronounce Nora's last name?
Mari.
Say it again.
Chibamari,
and Robert Moses, and we know Nora, but we don't see her enough. Pardon me, say it again.
Rashad Pidgeon is part of that too. He's been added into that.
Oh, really? Oh, nice. Oh, love him. Awesome. Yeah, and then you're going to be doing your next wave, which is really highly anticipated. Is that where's your next wave? I don't know. Is that also at Yerba Buena, or is
that in the
Dance Mission? Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, one of your longtime collaborators. And then you're at Laney College.
Go ahead. You're right.
Yeah, you're at Laney College February 28th through March 1st, and then you're at ODC March 6th through 8th, and you're going to be having Robert Moses Kidd. And Robin Moses goes back to the first festival. I remember he was, you know how you have your next wave, you have the mentoring, you know, you have the up-and-coming with the, you know, famous or established choreographer, and that was just really fabulous, you know. And also you have the tech stuff going where you have people learning about the business and the artistry of presentation, you know, people doing the lights and the sounds and the staging. And I think they might be continuing the apprenticeship part. I'm not sure. So what I noticed, though, that you end on International Women's Day. And I'm like, oh, that's kind of interesting.
March 8th.
So, so talk a little bit about, you know, sort of the overview. You know, Kendra, you could start, and then Laura, and then bring Gregory into his week.
Indeed,
we'll talk about his week.
Well, I can talk a little bit about the 50 Cent Tabernacle, which YBCA has been doing for, has it been over a year, I believe. And they've been doing, you know, a day of classes and offering it to the community for 50 cents for the entire day. So it's great that we're able to collaborate with them and do a BCF edition with artists that will be participating in the festival. We're also coinciding that with our what we would usually offer in Oakland as our Youth Summit. We're inviting our youth companies to take part in the 50 Cent Tabernacle and take classes all day, and then they will be doing an informal showing from 4 to 5. So not only do you get classes all day for 50 Cent, but you also get informal showings with pre-professional youth dance companies, Dimensions Extensions, Performance Ensemble, as well as Destiny Arts and the Village Dancers. So really excited about that we were able to, you know, it's always a goal of ours and just a joy to be able to include the youth, you know. So I'm really excited that they'll be taking part that weekend, or that to kick off the festival on February 9th that day. And Laura, did you want to talk a little bit more about YBCA and Nora?
Oh, yeah. So Mark Bamuti Joseph, it's just amazing having him there now as the Performing Arts Director at YBCA. The 50 Cent Tabernacle is his brainchild. It's an amazing opportunity for community to come and dance. It was, I think, 2 years ago that Bamuti and I started talking about the possibility of bringing Nora and her piece, Miriam. And it's exciting to have Nora back because I feel like she's still a child of the Bay Area, you know, creating and starting her sort of, you know, experience as a choreographer here in the Bay Area. She performed with Dimensions Dance Theater. She danced for me for a while. She was part of that quilt project, Pieces of Me, and did Robert Moses, a piece by Robert Moses, as well as a piece that I created, and was doing some amazing work here, the pilot series, and got very close to Kimi Okada and the ODC family. They really supported her developing work, as did Rob Bayless. And, of course, she spent a long time in New York working with Urban Bushwoman and continuing to develop her own voice as a choreographer. It is thrilling. I almost can't articulate because I'm so excited about her coming here to perform Miriam. She's now an award-winning choreographer, but at the core, she's a friend, a sister friend. She has a huge fan base here in the Bay Area because of all the time she's spent here. It's going to be quite a homecoming. And the piece that she's presenting is unique, like the artist. Nora is something else, very grounded, very real. And this piece is about, and her experience, feeling like others. And she's created a piece that takes the audience on a journey in knowing what it's like to feel as though you are other. She she plays with lighting and the way the form will be set up. It's very unique, and her play with lighting and music will take the audience on this journey that is going to be provocative and challenging and beautiful, and it will be as much theater as it is dance. People will probably be surprised. It won't be as dancey as Nora typically might do in some pieces, but the power that she gives, the charisma, and the artfulness of the work, is that a word? Artfulness of the work, I think, is going to be just a thrill for people to see and to experience. I'm very, very excited. Miriam. And I could go on and on, but I won't, just about her use, you know, her use of the idea of the Marys and Miriam and what that means about being a woman and being other too. So she hits a lot of different ideas, and but it's entertaining, and she's powerful and charismatic. The music is by Omar Sosa, the score. Yeah, it's going to be something to see, and I'm looking forward to it.
Mhm. Yeah. Nice. Nice. So that's going to be February 13th through 4th through 15th.
February. Yep. And it is there's no intermission, no late seating. And when you walk into the space, you're going to walk into the space as though you're walking into a museum with living sculpture. So it's already just so inviting. Just from the beginning, you walk into this living sculpture. Kind of atmosphere.
Sounds beautiful.
So I guess
so how do people get tickets for the Black Choreography Festival Here and Now? One nice thing about the festival is that of the intimacy. Except for Yerba Buena Center for the Arts, most of the venues are very intimate. There's no separation between the company and the audience. I mean, Laney College is a little bit bigger, but you have sold out.
It will be the same thing at YVCA because Nora is presenting Miriam in the forum space.
Okay, yeah, nice.
And we're walking in right up on her. I mean, I think.
I love it when they do that. So there are no risers in there.
I think maybe not. I think they were talking about perhaps not having them all up. That's not my area. I've been to just a few of the planning meetings, but I think you're going to certainly feel that intimacy and closeness in her piece as well.
Nice. Excellent. So how do people get tickets?
Well, there are a number of websites. There's the BCF Here and Now website that has links to purchasing tickets for the festival. So, again, it's BCF Here and Now.com, and you spell it out, Here A-N-D Now.com. You can go for the different theaters. Dance Mission has links to buying tickets through Brown Paper Tickets for Dance Mission and Laney, and then YVCA and ODC, they have their own, you know, box offices. So our website certainly is a one website for purchasing tickets. We have early bird specials. If you get advanced tickets, for instance, for all of the programs, coming one night to all of the programs, for 4 weeks it would only cost, and I think this is really reasonable, $85 for every night, because our early bird specials, we're offering $10 tickets to Dance Mission, $15 tickets to Laney, YBCA, for that amazing piece by Nora, they have $30 tickets in advance, and Robert has $18 tickets in advance.
And
so
with that early bird price, it's only $75 you'd be spending.
Oh, sorry, $75, yes.
Yeah.
I thought that was it, but I'm sorry, I was off by $10.
Yeah, that's it's a great savings.
Right. What did you say,
Yeah.
Greg?
They can donate the $10.
Right.
They can donate the $10.
Yeah. So, Kendra, talk a little bit. Talk about Gregory and how you met him, and and how you know his work and how he ended up being, you know, one of the presenters this season. And then Gregory, I'll read your bio, and you can tell us what you're, you know, sort of what you have planned for Black Choreographer's 10th anniversary.
Well, it was certainly, you know, wonderful to be able to present Gregory a few years ago at ODC through the Black Choreographers Festival, and I, of course, have seen his amazing work on stage. And I think, you know, Laura and I, we look back and want to support artists and bring them to a venue that, as Laura said earlier, would, you know, serve their work. And I think Laney's Theater is a great venue to be able to showcase Gregory's work. And, I really want him to talk more about what he's bringing and hear from him. But I'm certainly excited and honored that he is a part of the Oakland Laney Weekend, that his company is able. I don't think his company has performed in Oakland before,
yep.
So it's great to have him.
I know. Rob, I know that. I know Gregory's work has been shown in Oakland, maybe through Company C and other venues.
Right.
I just want to add in that one thing, Gregory, and we're gonna gush a little bit, okay? So just be ready.
Okay.
He is so incredibly kind-hearted and generous, and it was such an honor that first year, as Kendra's saying. I think it was 2011. Correct me if I'm wrong, Gregory. Where he's like, I got this little dance.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. I got this little dance company as a child. I was doing this little thing. And we're like, you're like, you know, as dancers, Kendra and I, we're in awe because you know, we have watched his amazing artistry with Alonzo Kingsline Ballet. And it's like, oh, your little company? These folks were fierce. They burned that stage up. It was crazy, amazing. They're gorgeous. And he has incredible dancers, artists within themselves from all over. And he burned that stage up. So when he then wanted to come and do more, we're like, oh, yeah. And then he's like, I want to come one more time. We're like, okay, that's good, too. And now let's find some serious funding for you, because what he hadn't done in the past was perform to live music. So this year he's performing to live music. And, Destiny, you may be familiar with Richard Howell and Destiny the Harpist.
Yeah.
And Glenn Pearson.
Oh,
right?
My. Yeah, nice.
Yeah. And, yeah, exactly. And they're all going to be playing live with
Oh, wow, that's awesome. So Gregory began his studies in Chicago at Ruth Page School of Ballet and then left for Southern Illinois to study ballet and Haitian dance with Catherine Dunham. Like, oh, my gosh. He moved to San Francisco where he studied with Evelyn Stewart at Charles Anderson Dance Studios and with Alonzo King at Dance Central. Mr. Dawson left for New York in 1982 to study with the Dance Theater of Harlem. From 1983 to 1986, he danced with Theater Ballet Canadian, returning to the Bay Area to perform with Oakland Ballet, Berkeley Ballet Theater, Sacramento Ballet, and the San Francisco Opera Ballet. Mr. Dawson joined Lines in 1987 and danced for 18 years with the company. Upon retiring from the company in 2005, he began to teach and choreograph for Alonzo King's Lines Ballet BFA at Dominican University of California and for the Lines Ballet Training Program. Students from the BFA program were selected to represent the Southwest region and perform solid soil, beneath our feet at the National College Dance Festival in New York. Mr. Dawson has also been on faculty for the San Francisco High School for the Arts for the last 7 years. In 2007, he formed Dawson Dance SF. In 2008, for Company C, completed Which Light in the Sky Is Us, which was nominated for an Izzy for choreography. In 2009, he became dance assistant director of the, is it City College of San Francisco? No.
State Summer School for the Arts.
Mm-hmm. Okay, dance department. In spring 2010, Mr. Dawson reset Venus, as in Hottentot Venus?
I'm sorry?
As in Hottentot Venus, as in Sarah Bartman, that Venus?
It's
when
called,
you say, when, is that the Venus that you, that's referenced here?
I'm sorry, I can't hear you. I can't understand what you're saying.
I said, is the Venus reference the black woman, the African woman, who was objectified, and they called
The Venus, it encompasses everything, the planet, and everything.
Okay. he said Venus for the 2010 season of David Taylor's Dance, and in spring 2011 created a new ballet for DTDT, Big Sky, Endless Mountains. In the fall of 2011, Mr. Dawson became artistic director of Dawson Wallace Dance Project in Denver, Colorado, formerly David Taylor Dance. In 2011, Mr. Dawson was selected to receive a Chime grant to be mentored by Elizabeth Stribb for a year, which ended in December 2012. And I want to ask you, what were the names of the pieces that you choreographed for Black Choreographers Festival Here and Now in the past, and what are you bringing this year?
Last year we did Au Printemps Romantique, which it's a Brahms Schumann, I think it was, piece. And it was kind of an excerpt of a larger piece that grew later. And then the previous year we did something else, and I can't remember, it was probably to Brahms as well, or someone classical, because I went through this whole phase with classical music. And I normally don't work with classical music. I usually compose my own music with Alfred Giovanni, who is an amazing artist himself. The last year that we did the Brahms and the Schumann, Laura, at first I'd like to thank Laura and Kendra. I mean, it's incredible what they do. Amazing people, very generous. The company just loves the festival, and they know how important it is to me. So when they're there, they feel that they're representing something deeper than the actual festival itself, which is, for me, important. So Laura saw the Brahms, and she said, well, this would be amazing live. And I'm like, yeah. And she said, well, let's work on that. And you know, the whole year I've been praying that that something would come of it. And she called, and she got the grant, and asked if I would do something to a different music, you know. And I was like, well, I'm pretty kind of like, if I hear something, I'm inspired by it, especially if it's wonderful. And she introduces me to Richard, and I heard his music, and you know how you leave your body and you're looking at yourself in ecstasy from hearing something so wonderful. That hit that moment. And it just really inspired me. And I was like, oh, my God. I called Laura immediately, and I got to have this music. When can we do it? How can we do it? And she says, well, let's wait and see what happens. And it happened. After hearing the music, I really, you know, I dream a lot, and a lot of the work that I produce comes from I can be walking and dreaming or sleeping and dreaming. And I sat down and I wrote this little paragraph, and it's kind of guided me through my process. We all aspire to bring breath to souls. Empowering someone to go beyond his or her own selfishness enables them to become humbled by the act of giving. It allows us and humanity to rise. The act presents us in a light that attracts beautiful moments and fuel our souls and gives us calm breath that sanctions us to ascend. We grow as human beings, and as spirits. So I was just kind of guided by that, and I took the music away with me, and I really studied the music, and then I came back in January, and I met Richard, who is a sweet man, very open, and for me, you know, when I have this kind of atmosphere, it really feeds me, and I just really want to go deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper, and he allowed me to kind of you know, I work a lot with GarageBand, kind of rearrange the music in a way that I think that would work for me. But, you know, he's come into a rehearsal and he's seen what I've done with that, and he took that information to heart, and I'm still working on it really, really heavily, trying to figure out how his ideas will commingle with my own. And I don't think that's going to be a problem, because he's an improvisationalist, and from experience in working with Pharoah Saunders, and like you were saying with lines, you know, I have a grasp on how it is to perform with live music and what is the foundation that us as artists and dancers will need to support their improvisation. And so this is where we are at the process right now. I've entitled the piece Bird's Eye View because we've been in rehearsal process since the beginning of January. Excuse me. And I've had this reoccurring dream that I'm looking at nests in a tree, like five nests for some reason. And I think that I might be a bird. I'm not quite sure. But the view is so clear. I'm looking through these woven nests. I would have to be something very small to see through these woven nests with feathers. And so it's also been the inspiration for my movement process. And the dancers are really, really enjoying it. And the challenge for us as a group, excuse me, is the music is actually structured in a way that we're not used to. The dancers are not used to. I am, because I'm much older. I'm used to having to really dive deep into the actual individual musicians and figure out where they're going with their improvisation and how that can support a structure that they can see what we're doing and continue to do what they do without having to, like, maybe have a consistent sound. They can change it nightly. They can be very free with what they want to do. And also, you know, working with really young dancers, I have amazing artists. Laura, it's right there. They're crazy, like we all are, but crazy in their art. And they will go everywhere that I ask them to go. The challenge is getting them to understand the actual history of this music and where it comes from and how it is it evolved and how it comes from the artist and comes out and where all that comes from, you know. And they're really enjoying the process. It's really hard because they're having to listen to each it's a quintet. It's each music, each musical instrument, and figure out how the movement that we've created is going to guide them through the process. It's an amazing, amazing process. I'm learning so much as a choreographer in trying to convey to my dancers the ideas that I'm hearing in the music and then having them empower themselves with the ideas that they're hearing and kind of work it all together with the both of us. I'm just stoked. I mean, it's such a blessing. I mean, how do you respond to, like, someone giving you this opportunity and it just, it's so warm. I just can't. I'm lost for words. I'm certain that the whole collaboration will be exquisite because the dancers are giving their blood for it. So.
I just look forward to as well seeing what you created and hearing E.W. Wainwright and Glenn Pearson and Frederick Harris and Destiny Muhammad with Richard Howell just you know, grooving on stage. I also wanted to say that you have a title now, which is exciting, and I would love for you to email me that title.
Give it
to a public.
That's funny. I noticed, Gregory, that you're performing February 28th through March 1st, as well as March 6th through March 8th. You're going to be at Laney College, and then you're going to also be at ODC Theater.
Oh, yeah, that's the time series. Oh, that's where the process started as well. Robert has selected me, along with Laura. I mean, God is good. I'm telling you, he really is, or she really is. And I get to work with dancers that have seen my career, and they know who I am. And Robert has been so gracious in allowing me to give my voice to his dancers in a very free, open way. And I've only had, I believe, 7 or 8 hours with them. And it's just really, for me, an amazing process because I'm my basis ballet, but my move is really grounded. And seeing how they approach it, and it's actually a schooling, actually. Seeing how they approach it and the way they approach it is totally different than the way I probably would, but I really love the fact that they're going to a place where they can receive my information and make it their own. And that's, for me, it feeds me, and it just makes me want to go deeper. So, yeah, I'm really excited about that. We have a couple more rehearsals, maybe 12 more hours, which for me is an infinity, especially if they're giving. So I'm excited about that, yeah.
Oh, that's great. So the previous weekend, the February 28th through March 1st, where you're going to be presenting your bird's eye view, I was thinking about, you talked about, the looking at the nest in a tree and, the woven feathered, imagery of the nest. And I was thinking, looking at your background in Haitian dance, I was thinking, wondering about the symbolism of the bird and the feathers. And I was wondering, sort of, do you put words to that for yourself?
I'm always in the air. I'm always ascending. It's something about being. I mean, I love traveling. I love being in an airplane. It's just something about the sky that really kind of appeals to me. And I don't know if it must come from ancestral rituals, or it's just. It's for me. It's about dreaming and being above and looking down on people and appreciating it and learning from it and giving and giving and learning to give it back to others. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Oh, I just wanted you can finish your thought. I just wanted you to maybe talk a little bit about your company members. Like, who are they? And how long they've been with your company. And then I have a follow-up question about sort of what's not mentioned in your, in your bio it's mentioned, about your work with Catherine Dunham. And I was just wondering if you could tell us a story. And then Laura and Kendra, wow, Kendra, your baby is letting you stay with us for a long time. That's so awesome. I wanted to come back to you all and let you all have some other comments about this particular weekend that Gregory is going to be participating in, and overall, the festival, this 10th anniversary.
I'd like to start with Catherine and Ms. Dunham. I mean, it was just
okay.
I was really young. I'm from Chicago, and I graduated from high school. I had danced, technical ballet and stuff like that, and then I went to study at Southern Illinois University at Edwardsville, which is near East St. Louis, where Ms. Dunham had a studio, but she would come into the campus. I am fluent in Italian, so I was studying Italian. And I decided to take classes while I was studying, and I went to the studio, and my, as I said, was ballet, but they were offering Afro-Haitian. And I went, I'm African, I can get into this. So I went in, and I just picked this class on the whim, and it was as if I didn't realize what history I was in the presence of. And it was just the most amazing experience. She saw how I was. that I had a classical background, and for some reason she knew of Alonzo. It was very strange. But she said, I mean, she knew that I had to, like, go to another place because my skills in the language, I had to go to another university. So she said, well, you know, I know of this man in San Francisco that you might be interested in. And that's actually how I met Alonzo. My experience with Mrs. Dunham was just that. She gave me Alonzo, that gift. I have amazing dancers. I mean, I can't emphasize that enough. All of them I've trained because of the programs at Lions Ballet. Isaiah Bendel, Jordan Drew, Jessica Wagner, Byron Roman, Oliver Schock, Ilaria Guerra, and Christopher DeVita, who can't join us this time because his sister is ill in Connecticut. They're all creatures. I like to think of myself a teacher who creates characters, and most of my dancers have really, really strong characteristics and personalities and minds of their own. And they actually are a large part of the process. The trust that we have in each other is so important because they believe and they know that I will go jump over mountains for them because I know that they would do the same for me. And I'm sure the audience, the viewers that have never seen them before, will notice that thing that I notice in them is that this light that shines bright and it brings you in and they take you on a journey with them and they allow you to see their souls, you know, and with no inhibition. And this is the kind of company that I would really want to sustain. Laura?
Yes, indeed.
I hear you, Gregory. Yeah, you got to keep Alonzo away from him, though. That's the only thing, right?
Well, but I, you know, that for me is a blessing because I'm honored. I'm so honored,
yeah.
And it's a challenge. You know, if he sees this bird I'm sorry.
I know. I'm just teasing you because he had a couple of young men. I think two or three, right?
Yeah,
that was working his choreography, and of course now they're dancing with Lines Ballet. So he trains them beautifully. They do amazing work for him, and then Alonzo says they're some badass dancers, and then
oh, that's funny.
Then
I just feel so honored that you know, and it really. You know, it really, the challenge is a blessing because it only makes me have to go deeper. And I always really want to go deeper. Yeah.
Right. I hear that. And it shows. It really does.
Sure.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Hey, Kendra, you have to talk about the newest addition to the that weekend on February 28th, my dear. She there?
I'm here, and I do have... a competitor in the background for airspace. But assuming that you might be talking about KKDE, we
that too, and as well as the film.
Oh, the film, absolutely.
Yes.
But can I just
but
say
please,
that, Gregory?
You,
I'm so.
I'm sorry.
Well, I was
going
to say I talked about KKDE earlier, but I wanted to say, Gregory, thank you for sharing that story. It's so beautiful. I love that connection between Catherine Dunham and you know, getting you here to San Francisco and Alonzo, and such a beautiful story. So thank you. But we have an addition to the evening on Friday at 6:30. We will be doing a screening of Upaj Improvisation, the film, which is a collaboration between Chitras Das and Jason Samuel Smith. And Jason Samuel Smith has been a part of the festival in its early years and has visited the festival at least three or four times. And so once I saw this film has happening, I wanted to have it be a part of our 10-year celebration. For sure, you know, as Chitris being one of my teachers and then Jason being a part of the festival, I just felt it was, you know, the right place for it. It actually aired on PBS and we'll be doing another primetime syndication on PBS in March. But when I saw the film, I just, you know, had chills and was in tears because it's such an amazing story of collaboration across generations and them both telling their stories and talking about preserving their art form, Kathak dance in India and the Americas, as well as you know, Jason and tap dance. And so they're able to come together on stages across the world and use the form of improvisation within Kathak and tap dance and just have some fire and amazing, beautiful experiences and performances. And so they've captured that on film. And I can't remember his first name, but Mahea Uchiyama, who's also been a part of the festival, her son actually directed the film. Antara from Chitris Das Company produced the film, and so I'm really gracious. Laura and I are both very gracious for them allowing the film to be a part of the festival. So we're going to be screening that on Friday, February 28th from 6:30 to 7:30, and then doing a talk back with the producer for about 15 minutes.
Oh, and that's a good one.
Yeah, right. And the screen, the showing is free with ticket purchase, so, yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. That should be really great.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that crazy great?
That's wonderful. Yeah,
because
I know the past you've had film festivals connected to
right.
the Black Choreographers Festival here and now.
Yes,
right.
So this is great. And for our 10-year For our 10-year, Kendra and I, we want to get film in there. We want to get
right.
film, but it wasn't coming
yeah.
naturally. It wasn't fitting, and mm-hmm. we never forced anything. We just waited,
mm-hmm.
and then this came out in December.
Right.
We both got the email, and we were like, what? It's your mentor,
yeah.
and Jason. This is
right.
it. This
yeah.
is the film. This is the
yeah.
film.
Awesome.
Celebrate the
awesome.
10-year. It just came to us. It's mm-hmm. crazy. And then Kendra just,
mm-hmm.
like, jumped in there and just looked it up. Wop, wop, wop.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that is heck of cool. Yeah, so also on your beacon that Gregory is debuting his new piece on the February 28th, the last weekend in February and March 1st, you're also featuring Joanna Haygood and Portia Jefferson. I thought, you know, sort of the having these three choreographers in this weekend, you don't do things accidentally, and you do things, you know, with intent. And so talk about the intention of this weekend. We've heard this wonderful, you know, sort of projection that Gregory has told us about, you know, what we have in store for ourselves. And it's like, oh, my goodness, can hardly wait. And then the following weekend we see his work, you know, on another company. It's like, oh, my gosh, it's just, you know, just like just sort of, just dancing out the festival, dancing out the 10th year with Gregory Dawson, signature, you know, like, okay, nice. But talk about this weekend, February 28th through March 1st.
So Portia, and Kendra, you make sure I'm saying this correctly, jump in. She's also celebrating 10 years, so I'm going to let Kendra talk about that.
Oh.
Kendra has that connection and with that idea of bringing Portia on for this weekend. And then Mark Lamuti Joseph will be joining us, and he'll be doing excerpts from Red, Black, and Green of Blues on Saturday, March 1st. And
okay.
Joanna, of course, is doing her Dying While Black and Brown. Joanna and Mark Lamuti have done these pieces, but they have not pieces in Oakland. Just as we saw Gregory's work being impactful and important to Oakland, you know, audiences from Oakland having an opportunity to see it here in Oakland. This is the kind of work that typically gets featured and presented in San Francisco, but not in Oakland. So it was
mm-hmm.
purposeful. We did want to see that amazing classical genre, the way Gregory does it, which is, you know, contemporary and fresh with the jazz quintet. And then Dying While Black and Brown when you have stories like Trayvon Martin, when you have stories like Oscar Grant. There was such a response from Oakland. These type of pieces that deal with the issues that we face socially in this country and in this city and in the, you know, Oakland and in the Bay Area around being black, and especially our black men. Joanna's talking about some of these issues that concern us all. This piece gets people talking. It's provocative. It's timely. It's right for Oakland. And then Red, Black, and Green are Blues, that is Bamuthi's story about his Life is Reading Festival, which you know he holds right here in Oakland. And this piece, though, has never been shown in Oakland. It showed for a very brief season in San Francisco. So I asked him specifically to bring excerpts about Oakland, as well as any other excerpts he wants to show and present in the festival, because that's a powerful piece. And I have a feeling there are a lot of folks from Oakland that did not get to the YDCA form when he performed this a couple of years ago. And, again, I think it's so much about what Oakland is and certainly what Oakland means to Bamuthi that it was the right place for it to be shown. Kendra, why don't you talk about Portia, and because that was really exciting that she came to you about her tenure.
Yes, certainly. Mm-hmm. Yes, she did contact me a while ago and shared with me, you know, the fact that Rabbi Toulemont is celebrating 10 years. And, you know, I thought it was fitting for her to celebrate on the festival stage, you know, with us celebrating 10 years as well. That's really what the festival is about. It's, you know, definitely coming together as community and celebrating each other and supporting each other's work. So it was really exciting to be able to have a place for her to not only, you know, show sometimes in some of our venues we're only able to present, you know, smaller work. So it's nice for her to be able to not only celebrate her 10 years, but to bring a more lengthy version of the work that her company does. So definitely proud and honored to be supporting her vision for their tenure. And I know they're doing a number of events and classes and performances throughout the year, but this is one of their larger performances that they'll be doing, I believe, other than their season.
And then, of course, Portia also represents that legacy because she is part of the Blanche Brown legacy. And Blanche Brown was one of the founding members of AAA PAC and has always been supportive of the festival as well over the years.
Yeah, yes, there's a certain synergy, inherent in just the programming of this this festival's 10th anniversary year. I mean, there's like a story within, okay, who's, you know, presenting each particular weekend, you know, how things are you know, sort of came together. You know, there's a story there, you know, sort of the, you know, sort of the invisible spirits working.
Yep.
You know,
mm-hmm,
while you're working
mm-hmm.
on the conscious level. It's
absolutely.
Like, wow. Are you all writing a book? Are you doing a film? Is a film being made about you?
Speaking of a book.
Let's talk about the book real quick, and then I have to say a little bit before we go about Synergy and Robert Moses and Draft. But talk about that book real quick, Ms. Kendra, because that's something else.
Yeah, so Kamara Dixon, who has been our photographer all 10 years and over the last years has been, you know, traveling here from Atlanta to shoot the festival. And so he has put together an amazing, beautiful book of photos throughout over the lapse of the 10 years. And when I saw it, I told Laura I was bawling because it's so moving. And he also wrote just beautiful commentary on the artist and spoke to what the festival means to him and I think so many others. So it's just a really wonderful way to commemorate the festival and the marking of the first 10 years and looking to you know, many more. So it's an amazing happening. We're really excited about that and so grateful to Kamara for putting it together. It represents his work in the community beyond words. It's just really amazing.
Oh, wow. So the...
it's a commemorative book. It's an artful book.
Yeah.
Book,
and it's available this year?
Yes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
it's
really?
It's
wow. You got to send... I didn't see that anywhere in any information. Okay, send me that information. Oh, how excellent. Because I know you've had Kamara's photographs as part of the art exhibits over the years.
Which will also be happening as well. He will be... he and Eugene, who is our graphic designer, will be having some work in the lobby space of Laney during the Oakland weekend. There's so many elements. I mean, the festival is really about walking in and experiencing and having an experience the moment you walk in. So really excited about showcasing their visual work in relation to the festival as well.
And because they now let us know that going to come back, we will be updating the press releases and including the fact that there will be gallery space and artwork at Dan's Mission and at Laney. And you talk about
great.
Synergy and ODP Theater. Memory is part of the Bi series with Robert Moses and Liz Comer and also Montevallo. Not saying his name right. Montevallo. I'm killing his last name. That's so awful. Make sure I get that name right for the next time I have a book. Say it again.
I think it's Montevallo.
Montevallo. Yeah. Thank you so much. That's right, Gravy Montevallo. He's doing the draft project as well, and that's when Robert Moses gets into a studio with a number of artists, and for each artist, he does a solo variation. And then he artfully puts all of the solo variations together into a piece. He drafts a piece. And he's going to collaborate with Ramon Ramos Ayello and Reginald Ray Savage just as choreographic ideas. They're going to be setting solos on company members. But then he's going to have dancer choreographers performing. Beat Chanel, Sabine Antoine Hunter, Arvion Jones, Rashidi Omari, Stephanie Powell from Los Angeles, Maïs Ciani, Raisa Simpson, and Latanya D. Tigner, as well as members of this company. We're going to all be on stage together dancing these solo variations that are created for them, unique solos for them.
Wow.
Another example of pure synergy in studio and then to the stage.
Wow, that's going to be awesome. You know, it's really interesting about your festival. a person can't just come to one weekend because every weekend is different. So people need to just go ahead and just get that, what is it, $75?
Early bird special. Yes, the early bird,
special. Yeah. And do you have family discounts and like you have in the past?
For the artist?
No. For like, you know, like I know, like if you, like a family of four wants to come, do you have anything like that?
What we do have is we have $10 tickets always for youth 14 and under.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah.
Excellent. Super.
And we always do it not one night that we decide is a pay what you can. That's usually on the next wave showcase. Usually that's Sunday. We always advertise that, but folks
which Sunday is that?
That is the 23rd. Folks have come to know that if they show that day and they really, you know, because part of our vision is always to have accessibility and affordability with the festival. So we try to find those ways that folks can come and, you know, be inspired and entertained.
And we also have a group rate. So if people, companies, organizations, schools, want to bring a group of folks, we do group rates, and they can call K-STAR's line, which is 888-819-9106 for
that
information.
Great. Thank you. Yeah, Well, my next guest is in the wings waiting, but I wanted to be clear. So at the Dance Mission venue on Sunday, February 23rd, that's the Pay What You Can?
Yes. We open it Sunday.
Oh, that is so awesome. Wow. Well, there's so many congratulations. And, you know, wow, the book, you know, the film, you know, having Gregory Dawson again, you know, as a part of the festival. Wow. It's been such a wonderful morning speaking to all three of you, Laura, Elaine Ellis, Kendra, Kimbrough Barnes, and Gregory Dawson. It's just simply wonderful, and I'm so looking forward to seeing you at these various, on these various stages and these various venues.
Thank you so much, Wanda. And you, we can't fail to mention that you are being honored at our honor ceremony on March 1st during the concert there, and just for your continued support in the festival and, you know, over the 10 years. So you are a part of 10 artists throughout the Bay Area that we'll be honoring on March 1st. So thank you, thank you.
Oh, wow. Okay, well, that's a nice surprise. I remember when I was a part of a panel. That was really, really fun. In the past. I don't remember what year that was, but that was really nice, talking about sort of the media and art,
right,
and, you know, black media and representation. Oh, well, thank you so much. I mean, I was coming anyway. I was missing for the world. You all are, you know, some of my favorite artists, and I just love seeing you out and about in the community, as well as, you know, when you put on your professional hats. Wow, and it'd be great to meet you, Gregory, since I've been admiring you for many, many years.
Thank you for the interview this morning. It's wonderful.
Thank you,
yeah.
Wanda.
Well, you're welcome. You all have a wonderful rest of the day, and looking forward to seeing you next week.
Okay, sounds
all
good.
Right.
Have a good one.
Thank
all right, you
too.
Take good care. Peace and blessings. You're
bye.
Welcome. Bye. Good morning, Mr. Henry Delson Williams. How are you?
Good morning, Wanda. How are you? I'm doing great. Thank you very much.
I'm glad you got my message. I'm so excited to talk to the Motown designer. Oh, my goodness. And one of your, you know, one of the women who whose wardrobe you are intimately involved with, Martha Reeves, is coming to town Thursday, February 6th. It's like, oh, my God, we can see it. It's like that close.
Yes, I am so excited. And she's going to be there talking about her 50 years of dancing in the street. I mean, the song is 50 years old. Isn't that something? And,
that's amazing. Amazing, yeah.
Ranked
1964.
That changed the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so you're
going to
have a
yeah.
good interview, Wanda. I'm happy for you, and congratulations on being honored. You truly deserve it, and more people in the Bay Area is going to know just a little bit more about you. We're taking it up a notch.
Cool, super. So so you first started designing clothes 30 years ago. And you were heavily influenced by the civil rights.
I just added it up. It's around between 40 and 45 years.
Oh, my goodness. Well, let me give you your props. 40, almost 50 years. Oh, my goodness.
Oh.
Yeah, and you were heavily influenced by the civil rights movement and the Black Panthers and the political policies of the time. And this reading from Inside Oakland says, today your designs are more influenced by jazz and African culture than politics, but you haven't forgotten where you came from. So why don't you talk a little bit about sort of, you know, your work as a designer, because, you know, you do a whole lot of different kinds of work besides designing, but you basically, how did you meet Martha Reeves? And so you were born and raised in Oakland, right?
Well, I was born in Louisiana, Pineville, Louisiana. I don't know if anybody knows about Pineville, but Pineville is like the hospital for the mental, but Pineville didn't have a hospital, so I had to be delivered in Pineville, which is okay with me. Then we moved. moved to Oakland when I was very, very young, around 4 or 5 years old, and lived in the projects next to the last street in Oakland, Wood Street, Willow Street, all up in there. And I had a paper route on 7th Street. My route was 7th Street, 7th Street, Esther's Arbor Room, Slim Jenkins, and Henry Street, all up in there where Bart is.
Mm-hmm.
So full circle, we're bringing it back around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Was your family involved with like the Black Panther Party movement? Any of your siblings or anything?
You know, they wasn't that political. I open up the original brothers. Some of you older guys out there might remember the original brothers. It was located at 18th and San Pablo, where Sweet Jimmy's was back in 1968, before I went to Hollywood. And during that time was the political change in the atmosphere. White folk began to love the blues, and Oh Happy Day was recorded. I did those robes for Edwin Hawkins and the choir, by the way. And we begin to recognize that black is beautiful, and really beautiful. So I was one of the first to make dashikis downtown on 18th and San Pablo, and did quite well at it. But in 1970, I decided I wanted to go to Hollywood to be a star, and couldn't nobody tell me anything different.
Wow. So how did you get into design? You mentioned the original brothers. What was the original brothers?
The original brothers, it was like three of us and one style hair. We had an Afro shop right across the street from the dashikis on San Pablo there. And we come out with the Afro hair sheen and oil and all that in 1970. And I have the pictures of the cans and everything. I wish I had one of those cans. Anyway, Johnson & Johnson kind of took over from there in 1972, and the rest is history. Long story.
Wow, that's amazing. So how did you get in? How did you end up? Why did you leave Oakland and go to L.A. in 1968?
Well, because I really early on as a kid in the projects, the little TV we had, I always said when I was grown I was going to Hollywood. And so I decided that in 1970 that I would go to Hollywood and design for the stars and make movies. And looked up, within a year I was doing exactly that. So I left here on a high, quite known. And so when I went there, it was quite easy for me to just step right on in Motown and all of the rest of them. They had heard about me.
Yeah. So tell us some stories, particularly about you and Martha Reeves. But tell us some of the stories of your time at Motown, because you were there for quite a while.
Well, I'm actually still there. I take a busload to Hollywood every September, the third week in September, and we have dinner with Berry Gordy and Smokey and all of the Berry Gordy family at the Beverly Hills Hotel, the HAL Awards. This year we're serving our 25th anniversary, and all of the stars are going to be there. So those of you out there who would love to go, call Wanda, call the museum, and let's go downtown and go to L.A. and Hollywood and represent Oakland, the area.
Wow, that's awesome. So, so tell us, you know, about, you know, sort of they already knew about you, so tell us some of the stories. Tell us, tell us some stories about you and your work with the stars in Hollywood.
You know, there are so many exciting stories. I don't even know where to begin. I know that I met Martha. One of my musician friends brought her by my house. And I had made up a bunch of fantasy Disneyland type of clothes and gowns and stuff for the theater. And she tried stuff on, and she put on a gown, and the rest is history. I've been designing for her ever since. We've done Vegas together with the Diana Ross and the Smokey and the Supremes, and just a wonderful life. I'm glad I left here. That gives me the kind of history that I can lean on right now today and be very proud of myself.
Yeah. So when Martha Reeves, she's going to be here actually at the African American Museum and Library on Thursday, February 6th, for one night only. A donation of $30 is requested, and people can call 510-637-0200 to make reservations. And she's going to be talking and singing, telling the story of dancing in the streets, you know, that song that's, you know, basically, you mentioned that it's seven. What's the number on the charts? Because it's still famous.
The
tenth.
Song
yeah.
That mm-hmm. changed the world, number
yeah.
seven.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is a great achievement, and it chills my body and mind every time I think about it, because when I was there, I didn't realize what greatness I was dealing with. And sometimes you have to look back at history. But in the meantime, you have to just steady work at what you do and don't get distracted. I got distracted, but I come back. And I'm here for good now. And so I say to everybody, let's take it up a notch. You know, Oakland is growing, the Bay Area is growing, and things are going to be all right in a minute here. But we've got to do it together. I can't do it by myself. Wanda can't do it by herself. She's doing a fine job. She's been there. Wanda, how many years have you been on radio and the newspaper?
I started doing this. I started the radio show in 2009, in August.
It seems like longer than that.
yeah. I started it because, I really wanted to give voice to the survivors of Hurricane Katrina, because I'm also from New Orleans, and so I thought it'd be great to have the show start broadcasting in August, and a friend of mine who was had a program on the African Sisters Media Network, introduced me to the sister who is in charge of the network, and she gave me a platform which I'm using still, and I've been broadcasting ever since. I started with just like 30 minutes. And then I went to 2 hours twice a week.
Can I bring you some more interviews later on?
Oh, certainly,
some other stars like to.
Oh, that'd be awesome.
Yeah, I want to support you. I've watched you over the years, and I turn around, and she's still here. Let me get with her and work together. So since
super.
I know the stars and I'm working in that capacity, we got something going on, Wanda. We will do great things.
Oh, that'd be awesome. Yeah. So let's talk about this song, Dancing in the Streets, that was written by Hunter, Ivy Joe, Marvin Gaye, and William Stevenson. Ivy Hunter, Marvin Gaye, and William Stevenson. And just maybe tell us that story of how Martha Reeves and the Vandellas ended up, singing that song, because it wasn't planned. It just sort of, she just walked into it and just sang the song, and it became an anthem for that particular American mindset, because at that particular time in American history, people were saying, no, we're not going to go along with the previous, you know, sort of mindset around who we are as a people. You know, we're gonna be, you know, we're going to, I guess, recognize and step into our African, Pan-African history, and we're going to, you know, sort of not follow the government if it's not, you know, representing us well. And so, you know, she talks about dancing in the streets, you know, sort of taking the streets back, so to speak, in Philadelphia and Baltimore and Washington and Detroit and, you know, did she mention California? Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, California, all over the place, Virginia. Why don't you just talk a little bit about that? Have you talked to her, Martha Reeves, about this song and what it meant?
Well,
what it
as
means?
You know, it's a metaphor. To this house ain't big enough for the party. Let's take it to the streets. If you got a message, a political message, this building ain't big enough. Let's take it to the streets. So it's a metaphor for so many things all around the world. And as she named the different states and cities and all that, it's for everybody. And every culture can understand that. When we were kids riding around in cars and stuff, and if a good record come on, we'd stop the car and get out and cut us a step right in the middle of the street.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I wouldn't advise y'all to do that today.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. I'm so excited, Wanda.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I feel so blessed. My father was a quartet singer, and so I've always sang, but there was no money during that time, so I wanted to be close to the arts. And I tried to figure out a way, and so I said to myself, well, if I make clothes for the stars, I'll be right there with them, just in case they need a background singer or singer. But back to Martha Reeves. Martha Reeves was the secretary at Motown, and they were going in the studio to do the song, and the girl didn't show up. I don't know if she got sick or what it was. And Martha said, I'll do it. And the rest is history. So that is a story right there. And it says, be ready, because you never know.
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah. Yeah, her voice has been synonymous with the sound of young America.
Yeah. Yes,
wow.
It was.
Interesting. Mhm. Yeah. Wow. Well, you know, I don't have the song, unfortunately, up for people to be able to listen to it, so we just have to go and listen to it. But next show, I'll make sure I have it up so I can play it.
Well,
so
they don't even have
to
wait that long. Just come out with you to the African American Museum next Thursday at 7:30. And we'll meet you all out there. So come on and let's dance in the streets.
Yeah. You were honored by the Bay Area Blues Society, and you got you're a Hall of Famer now, and that was a really wonderful ceremony.
You know, that was one exciting moment. I always wondered would I ever get an award for anything, but it didn't. I was going to do what I enjoyed doing anyway, and so that was just an extra bonus. Now I want you all, you can drive up and down 7th Street right now and see what's getting ready to happen. Right in front of BART, they have black squares in front of Bart on the sidewalk where mm-hmm. the bronze plaques are going to be laid in April, and we're going to have a big celebration down there. People like Sammy Davis Jr., Ray Charles, Eartha Kitt, yeah, Aretha Franklin,
nice.
Eddie James, mm-hmm. Lenny Williams, Edwin Hawkins, and yours truly is blessed to get
wow.
a star as well. And it's going to be right
nice.
In front of Bart, right there where
mm-hmm.
Megabus drop and pick up, and now we got
mm-hmm.
Boat Bus financed by Greyhound trying to get their customers back from Megabus because, you know, you can go to L.A. for a dollar on Megabus
mm-hmm.
if you time it right.
Yes.
So things are changing.
Wow, so you're one of the Hall Walk of Fame. Wonderful.
Yeah,
congratulations.
Isn't that going to be a blessing? That is really,
yeah, nice.
Really going to change my life forever.
Yeah.
I would say that's my tombstone. That's my
wow.
blessing, and people will remember all of the efforts that I've put in all of my life. I've made great sacrifices,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't know why at the time it was an instinct and an urge. And
mm-hmm.
So we never know where we come from. I'm always interested in family, and I just found out that my great-great-grandfather, who was a slave, was torn from his family from one plantation to another plantation where he made shoes for the master and the slaves.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And so we all got great history there. We just got to start doing research, and you're going to be up for a surprise. And the prize is that all of us are related.
Yeah, yeah. So April what? When is the ceremony for unveiling this sidewalk of fame?
Well,
yeah.
We got to get together with Ronnie. The stage where we're in now, they're making the first bronze sample that was sent
mm-hmm.
in about 3 weeks ago. In about 3 weeks, they'll send that back to us, and then we will approve it, and then
mm-hmm.
It'll take approximately 6 more weeks for them to make up 85. That's going to be 85 in phase one.
Nice.
Wow, yeah, and so
85.
It's going to take weeks to do that. And
mm-hmm.
So I've totaled it up to around April or May. In the meantime,
okay.
we're planning celebrations and parties and stuff and after parties at the African American Museum. We're
mm-hmm.
bringing Martha Reeves back, some of the
mm-hmm.
Supremes and other stars. We're going to have a big celebration, kind of like Art and Soul. We've taken over the streets.
Nice, nice. So Ronnie Stewart is a part of this this Walk of Fame?
Oh, Ronnie Stewart is the CEO, and I'm honored that he brought me in to serve with him.
Okay.
Yes, he is.
Okay.
What a great man, and he's been working on this project for 22 years. All of you young folks, sometimes it don't happen overnight, just stay true to the game.
Yeah, yeah.
And so then his dream after 22 years is finally, finally coming through. I went to a town hall meeting, and we just received $3.29 million for phase two. And then there's going to be 75 more plaques that are going to be laid, and it's going from Henry Street, no
mm-hmm.
pun intended, all of the way down to the post office.
Okay.
75 more plaques are going to be laid in front of where Slim Jenkins was and Esther's Arbor Room. I don't know all of the names who are going in on that. But
wow.
we were all picked. Us 150 were picked out of 600 potential others.
Okay. Wow.
So,
yeah.
I mean, I won something.
Yeah,
Other than just being born.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So,
you know, when you mentioned your grandfather, that was really interesting when you talk about your grandfather and that he made shoes, and, you know, you're a designer. That's really wonderful to know that history. A lot of people don't know, you know, being aren't able to go back so many generations. Can you go all the way back to your ancestry in Africa? I mean, do you go back that far to know, you know, where your African ancestors also, you know, working in what do you call it, industrial design or
well, I'm getting ready. After celebration, I'm going to reveal, I'm going to have that DNA test done. And
nice.
I'm going to reveal the results at that celebration.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
You mean the one in April or May, whenever?
Do you know, I might do it in, yes. yeah, let's do it then.
Yeah, and I'll come out to you.
I know it's on the west coast of Africa. And I had heard something about they tricked the slave. My great, however many greats it was, he was a kid, and they told him that it was a bunch of molasses on the boat. When he got on the boat, the next thing he knew, he was chained and brought to the slave block in Jackson, Mississippi.
Oh, yeah.
See, and so from there, they kind of spread out from there after being freed to Natchitoches. And some of the Natchitoches line is at Natchitoches, Louisiana. Do you know about Natchitoches? Natchitoches is like a little small New Orleans. It was the first city in Louisiana. This year they're celebrating their 300-year anniversary. Uncle Tom's Cabin is there, and the slaves settled in Natchitoches.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where some of my people come from. All of you guys, you have interesting history out there, and it's not hard to find. Just go to the old people and ask them what was Grandpa's name and stuff, and then go to Amazon.com or either Jenny.com. We'll talk about it some more.
Yeah.
And in the end,
you know,
we're
going to
together.
Go ahead. Right.
Yes.
You know, I had my ancestry done through an organization called African Ancestry, and they have the largest database for African DNA. And Gina, who is the president of African Ancestry, they're out of Washington, D.C., she told us about sort of how it works, you know, insofar as sort of being able to go back, I don't know, 100,000 years or whatever. But she said that to find out, you know, both sides of your ancestry, you actually have to get a male member of the family to get the DNA done, and you find out, you know, the patrilineal line, and then you get a female relative, like a sister or aunt or mother, and you get the matrilineal line, and then together you get the story.
I'll call you back on that. We'll talk later on that. on that, because this is going to be exciting. I think a lot of people are going to want to come out to find out. I'm going to tantalize them with it.
Okay, cool.
And see, now you can find out yours too now. You know, mine's no different than yours. You got great history too. Anybody that can survive being chained up and brought from one continent to the other and make it, only the strong survive.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Have to realize how strong that we really are, and don't waste life and take advantage of it.
Certainly. Yeah, I was wondering, I have another guest coming on in a few minutes, but she hasn't arrived yet. And I wanted to ask you if you could talk a little bit about Afar Clothing Design, your enterprise that stands for American Food with African Roots. Why don't we talk about that? Because it fits in with what we're talking about right now with regards to our ancestry, and both researching that and celebrating that, because That's why, that's how we're here, because of that ancestry.
Well, do you know it's a God-given name that we arrived at because we didn't know how far we could take it? We was just trying to get an acronym out of a phrase, American fruit with African roots turned into afar. And I happen to look on the map every day at Africa, and in Ethiopia there is a place called Afar. And Afar is where Lucy is born. The Beatles sung a song about Lucy. Lucy is the 4-million-year-old skeleton they call Eve. She was found in Afar. Then I knew that I had the right name. And it just worked for me in so many ways.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's it's a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful name. And when I was reading, this interview of you, that's kind of old now, I had known about that, and I thought it was really great.
Now, all of you Spanish brothers and Orientals and even white folk out there, scientists will tell you that we all come out of Africa. So we can all claim American fruit with African roots, any of us American citizens. So I like that part because it includes everybody. God made all of us, and it includes everybody, and it's also good for business.
Right, yeah. So is Miss Reeves going to be wearing something that you've made for her on Thursday evening? Is she going to be,
That's what I'm working on now.
Okay.
I'm working on something for her. You know, once you get off that plane, it's going to be all of the formalities and all of that stuff. And then after that's out of the way, she's going to say, "What you got for me?" And then I'm going to have to say, "Let's go to the studio," and I'll be praying, "Oh, Lord, let it fit. Let it work. Let it look good on her."
Yeah.
So,
I was
praying all the way through art like that, you're almost guaranteed a hit.
Right. Yeah. I was just thinking about just the wonderful. I mean, just looking at the line. The Henry Delton Williams line. It's just so like regal, and I mean, you just make the people that you have dressed and have, been able to wear your garments, they just look so good and so regal. And, I mean, it's just, so fitting for who they are. And even if, they don't know they're that great, just putting on a garment makes them change their attitude, which goes to show you, Yeah. And I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit, since my guest, she was in the studio and then she left. I would love you to talk a little bit about the artistry of design and how you do that. And then do you take your design and let someone else, do you have a factory where you have people making, you design it and some other people make it? And if so, how many people do you employ? And just sort of, have you seen yourself as a trendsetter? You create a design, one of your artists wears it, and then all of a sudden you see copies of this design in the larger society. You see people wearing your work, but they don't know that they're wearing your work.
Oh, I've seen that. I'm so glad you brought that up. I've seen that so many times, and I can't even begin to explain the feeling seeing somebody with something on you design at the marketplace or somewhere, and you don't let them know who you are. You just want to see how they play in your design. It's a great feeling. It really, really is. What can I say? What I want to do is I have really retired, but I do special events, you know, like when Martha Reeves come into town and mm-hmm. maybe some minister might want a robe. And if he's been pretty good to me, I'll sacrifice my time for something. Usually what I'm getting ready to do is give my last big fashion show, and it's going to be bigger mm-hmm. than life. I mean, big clothes, you know, like you see on big gowns, big fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
And then I want to have a 10 proteges. That's mm-hmm. going to, I'm going to introduce them as I step off.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to do that at the museum sometime this year, and mm-hmm. you'll be involved in that. It'll be a great thing.
Okay, cool, super. All right,
yeah,
cool. I'm looking forward to that.
I'm 73, and I've had a good one. I want to move on and pass it on,
mm-hmm.
pass on all of this talent, you know, that I have to others, and that's what I like to enjoy doing most mm-hmm. now.
Yeah, so you have some apprentices?
Yes. Yes,
okay.
I have many, and I'm going to give them the opportunity to show their talent, and then I'm going to leave it to them, you know, may the best man win, male or female.
Yeah, so how did you learn how to design? Did you work with someone? Did you go to school for design? If so, where did you go to school? How did you come into this, you know, working, you know, with, you know, in this type of, you know, working with fashion design? How did you come into this? Because your work is very original. I mean, you know, like you set trends, and I was wondering sort of how did you come into this?
In junior high school, I actually wanted to be an architect, and a white teacher told me that you can't do that. You take up a trade. And I used to hear my father talk about taking up a trade that conditioned him and the rest of us. Don't try to be no doctor or lawyer. Just take up a trade. That's all you can do. So I picked other things, and for one reason or the other, and then I started designing, and I said, this is it. This is it. So when I do a design, I come at it with a basic foundation, and then as I go through the motion of it, I'm inspired to add in other things to the creation. And I'm continually inspired as I'm going through it. Oh, Lord, I hope this works. I hope it fits. You know, this is actually praying. I'll add in something else I've been inspired by. It could be my surrounding. It could be something Wanda said to me, and it pops up in my head later on. And that's how it happens, and I know it happens with any other artist the same way.
Okay. Yeah, wonderful. So you wanted to be an architect, and, you know, actually the building is the human body, huh?
And
design the clothing.
Absolutely, and I wound up being one anyway, because in designs, there's a whole lot of math. It's a whole lot of the rest of it, mm-hmm. all of the numbers and things. Everything is numbers.
Yeah.